Since 2013, Bombas has donated over 100 million socks, underwear, and T-shirts to those facing homelessness. If we counted those on air, this ad would last over 1,157 days. But if we counted the time it takes to make a donation possible, it would take just a few clicks. Because every time you make a purchase, Bombas donates an item to someone who needs it.
Go to bombas.com/ACAST and use code ACAST for 20% off your first purchase. That's bombas.com/ACAST, code ACAST.
It's that time of the year. Your vacation is coming up. You can already hear the beach waves, feel the warm breeze, relax, and think about work. You really, really want it all to work out while you're away. Monday.com gives you and the team that peace of mind. When all work is on one platform and everyone's in sync, things just flow wherever you are. Tap the banner to go to Monday.com.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom. Like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Welcome to Podcast Like It's 1992. This is Phil speaking with a little bit of a heads up that after myself and Emily and Chris and Joe and I are done talking about Batman Returns, I had the pleasure of interviewing one of the screenwriters of the movie, Daniel Waters. So that interview will be tacked on after we finish talking about the movie, but I wanted to give everyone a heads up about that. It's a great interview. Daniel is hilarious. We talk about all the sort of weird and wonderful things that went into the making of the film and the development of the movie and the various sort of iterations of the script that existed and all the things that Daniel loves and perhaps has some reservations about in terms of the film. But it's a great interview, and I hope you all stick around to check it out. Welcome to Podcast Like It's 1992, the podcast where we talk about the films of 1992 here from our perch in 2023. I am one of your hosts, Phil Isco.
I am your special guest host, Emily St. James, sitting in for your normal host, a terrible little penguin man. Honestly, I was going to do like a different Batman villain because like there's so many weird ones, but she's a terrible little penguin man.
A terrible little penguin man. Today, from This Had Oscar Buzz, we have Joe Reed and Chris Pyle. Thank you so much for coming on.
Thank you. We are the two actual little penguins that you're strapping a bomb to.
Right.
This will shock no one. This is probably my most anticipated movie to cover from 1992.
I was going to say, I imagine amazing. The competition was fierce for a guest star on this episode.
The competition between Phil and I was fierce.
There were some texts back and forth, and I felt genuinely bad because I was being perhaps a little bit too protective of this movie.
One text where Phil was like, I know you don't like this movie very much, so I want to make sure we get a real super fan. I was like, Phil, I'm gonna give this a score in the 80s. Like,
are you? Because I just read your Letterboxd review.
This is objectively a very good movie. I don't click with it. Like, that's the spoiler.
I mean, we will unpack all of that because sure. I'm very curious to sort of unpack the whole Tim Burton of it all. Emily, you were obviously notoriously on Blank Check to talk about his Nader, which is Alice in Wonderland.
I mean, absolutely one of the best films I've ever had the pleasure of seeing.
A great episode, though. A terrible, terrible film. But Joe and Chris, yes. I want to sort of, this is a movie that did have Academy Award nominations.
Two.
It had nominations. Yes, it did. Yes.
What were they? Forgive me, I should know this, but
visual effects and makeup.
Fair on both counts, I guess. I mean, the visual effects are very sort of pastiche-y a little bit. Like, it's more kind of like German expression. Like, it's hard for me to kind of be like,
this
is in 92, you know.
Sorry, this is such a weird era for visual effects Oscars, because it's this weird transition point between practical effects and holy CG. Like, the next year, Jurassic Park wins. This year, Death Becomes Her wins, and that's like a huge breakthrough in computer-generated effects. Yeah. But like, you still have some of these practical effects movies. Like, Batman Returns is mostly practical. There's some CG in there, but like this, so it's still bouncing around.
And I mean, the previous year, you have T2, right? That's 91.
That's another huge breakthrough,
which is a big breakthrough. So this is kind of this weird in-between space, it feels like.
Yeah.
But the makeup, I mean, Danny DeVito's makeup is pretty unbelievable.
Incredible.
But I want to ask you guys your history movie. Did you see this film in theaters?
This is one of my earliest movie memories of seeing a movie in a theater. I had definitely been to the movies plenty of times by this age. I would have been, I guess, 5 years old when I saw this.
Wow.
And it always strikes me in the opening credits too, because I was so terrified in the opening credits. And I remember this vividly because I was with both of my parents, which never really happened in terms of movie going. There's probably I could count on one hand the movies I remember seeing with both my parents. And I remember either like hiding under my mom or dad's arm, and at some point in the movie hiding under the actual seat. But the thing that's so scary to me in the opening credits is the basket that Oswald Cobblepot is floating down the river in, because for some reason in my brain, my like basically toddler brain, I convinced myself that it was a monster head coming out of the water. Not that it's a basket, but a monster.
You do get that at the end when he comes out, when he emerges out of the water.
Yes.
At the very end.
It's also a movie that every time I rewatch it, even as I approach like 40 years old, I still get the sense memory of how it felt to be scared by individual moments of this movie. Mm-hmm. And I think the thing that scared me the most was the shot of the electrocuted Max Schreck.
Uh-huh.
Oh, yes.
Just because I probably hadn't seen
the eyes.
And like, I'm sure we'll get into the whole conversation around kids and like kids on talk shows being like, Batman Returns is anti-kid, like fucking losers. But truly, probably the first time I had seen something so violent, so young.
Yeah.
But I don't remember like my parents thinking, oh, this is too much for you, or
like when you left the movie, they didn't go like, maybe we shouldn't have taken him to see that, or nothing like that?
Not that I remember. I mean, I more so vividly remember just the movie itself.
Sure.
I remember we saw it in a dollar theater. Remember dollar theaters?
Oh, sure. I do. I got my money's worth at the dollar theaters.
Which is
sure.
probably why they were less concerned about me freaking out, you know, and not just and like wouldn't need to take me out because I'm disturbing other people in the theater because they paid a dollar for me to see this movie.
Joe, did you see this in the theater?
I was trying to remember. I'm trying to think of the context that I would have seen it in the theater. I can't imagine my parents taking us all to go see Batman Returns. I definitely remember the first Batman, the hype around the first Batman, but I was not even 10 yet. This one, I was like 11 years old. What I remember is, and it may have been the first time I saw it, was watching it at home on VHS at like a family party where like the kids sort of got like thrown to the back bedroom and like you all go like watch a movie somewhere or whatever. And I remember watching it in that context. And I remember it must have been the first time I saw it, because why else would it be like much of a memory? And I remember being, if not outright confused, then just sort of just like kind of fascinated by this thing that was purportedly sort of marketed at least partially to kids, and watching this and like, oh, this is like without maybe even like knowing it, like this is sort of really melancholy and really sort of like, you know, moody for like much moodier than the movies I was probably used to. And I don't remember specifically, I wish I could like tell the story of being one of those cool kids who've been like, I loved Batman Returns from the break. I was a, you know, I was a spooky kid. I was a cool kid. I knew better than whatever. Mm-hmm. I probably was a little, you know, more than a little nonplussed by it and didn't come around to liking it as much as I do now for, you know, until I was an older teenager, if not like, you know, well into 20s. My 20s, yeah, or something like that. Yeah.
Now, Emily, I know you didn't see this in the theater because I think your God-fearing parents wouldn't allow it.
Was it was not. But... Well, no, like here, I actually do have a story around this. I was like, this was the first summer when I was like starting to push to like see some movies on my own. Sure. And we had to drive a solid hour to get to the nearest movie theater. So you like really had to want to see a movie.
You had to want it. Yeah.
Yeah. And so famously, the only two movies I saw in theaters in 1992 were Aladdin and Sister Act. So like that was the
best. That makes sense.
I was like,
you don't need anything else.
Yeah, exactly. I was like, I really want to see Batman Returns because I hadn't even seen the first one, but I like wanted to be like a part of like the big summer movie conversation. Sure. And the next year, like I convinced my parents to let me go see Jurassic Park by myself, and they were all set to let me see Batman Returns by myself. Mm-hmm. And I was such a fucking I mean, we'll get into this in the Twin Peaks Fire Walk with Me episode. Okay. But I was such like a kid who was like very self-censorious. Like I would like make sure I wasn't going to consume stuff that would make my parents upset.
Right.
So I read all the articles about how this movie was bad, and I went to them and I was like, I don't think it would be responsible for me to see Batman Returns. Right. I literally said it that way. Then I saw it when it debuted on broadcast television. It looks like 3 years later it debuted on NBC. I liked it, but I also don't know that that's the ideal way to see it.
No, probably not.
And like I don't think I saw it again until honestly last night may have been
in between
the first
ads for it. Mad About You, and I'm trying to think of like what you would have like gotten ads for then, like Law and Order, Mad About You,
I definitely have rewatched it at least once, but like last night was like the first time I'm pretty sure in a long
time.
I will say however that when it aired on broadcast television was the first time I was like, oh, you can set a movie that's not about Christmas at Christmas. This movie was like that for me. So,
you know, it's interesting. I had a very similar experience, I think, to you, Joe, in the sense that, I mean, I did see it in the theater. My mom literally pulled me out of class. That's how badly I wanted to see this movie.
Oh, wow.
I was 12. She let me play hooky. She took me and some other friends to go and see it. I vividly remember this. I remember just kind of not getting it. Like I felt as though, I think similar to you, Joe, I was 12, but I just kind of was like, I don't know that I'm on its wavelength.
Mm-hmm.
And I think it was ultimately, I really do think that despite the fact that this film has any number of horrifying images that young children shouldn't be seeing, I also feel as though it's not particularly fun, right? Like it's not a movie that a kid would be like, I mean, I guess there is Batman-y stuff. He blows up some stuff and whatever.
It's so fun now. Like for an adult, it's like so fun. But
Even on like the base level of it's the literal least colorful Batman villains, you know.
So for a movie just, with like
they don't even have primary colors. Yeah. They're black and white.
And they're circus black, white, themed and villains. And blue. They're circus themed villains and they're not even very colorful. Like it is
it's also muted. It's crazy.
I will say, like, I think one of the weak links of this movie for me, just in terms of a cinematic, is the action. You can tell Tim Burton wants to be doing something else. Yes. And you're watching it the whole time and you're like, come on, get back to the sexual malcontents, Tim. Let's do that.
That's what you care about the most. Yeah, get back to the BDSM sex love story. Yeah. I mean, it is, as is the case with Tim Burton, and we'll talk about this, I'm sure, at length to some degree in terms of where his attention goes and how, like, as a filmmaker, I don't know that he is, as Emily just sort of said, particularly good at juggling a bunch of things, right? Like you can tell that he's interested in the villains more than the heroes. He's always more interested in the ghosts or the creatures than the humans. Like it's always sort of a balancing act that he's not always that great at. what's interesting about this film is, you know, Michael Keaton sort of notoriously was like, I don't really want to do this fucking movie unless you pay me a boatload of money, which they did for a quote unquote real estate deal. We don't need to get into that. I don't know what that means, but that's what he said he needed the money for. And one of the big things that he said to Daniel Waters, who I interviewed and we're tacking on the interview at the end of this episode, which was a lot of fun. And he's amazing and really kind of got into the nuts and bolts of sort of the development of it, was he didn't really want Batman to talk very much. Now, whether or not that's just him being a lazy actor or if that was an actual choice, but I think that that presents itself as the villains are going to swallow Batman, right? Like there's no way to find that balance.
Yeah.
If you have an actor who wants a very kind of reserved Batman.
And yet you think about it and it's like, I'm somewhat hard pressed to think of too many Batman movies where the villains don't swallow Batman. And I think correct. Part of that is just sort of what you get with Batman, where he's moody and he's behind this sort of like metric ton of costume. Like there's so much costume to do with Batman. It's not like, you know, even like a, you know, a Captain America or certainly a Superman or whatever, like you're sort of your classic heroes. He's really like, you know, there's a lot of barrier to cozying up to Batman. And meanwhile, like Jack Nicholson certainly is the show in the first Batman. And then you get into the Schumachers where like nobody is going bigger than Jim Carrey and Schwarzenegger and Uma Thurman in those movies and Tommy Lee Jones. God. And then you get into the Nolans and it's like Bale's certainly going bigger than any of the previous Batmans, but like, you're up against, you know, Heath Ledger as the Joker and you're just sort of, you know, you're not getting more attention than that. And so part of that is just sort of like, that's kind of the Batman deal. But like, obviously the thing about, you know, Burton being much more interested, even just in like a characterization, like there's, if you were to be like, what's Batman's deal in this movie? And you're like, occasionally horny for Catwoman.
Yeah, horny duality. Sort of like,
and that's sort of the extent of it. He's like a little bit annoyed by Max Schreck. And that's like, and that's sort of the extent of what's going on. And luckily
Max
for
Schreck
me,
is probably a bigger character than even Bruce Wayne is in this movie.
Right.
Kinda.
Right.
Yeah.
Because there is an element, I think, of the first Tim Burton Batman that Bruce Wayne is a bigger character than Batman. It's more about Bruce Wayne than it is about Batman. And to this point, like, we don't really even get much Bruce Wayne in this movie until maybe the second half.
Yeah, it's, you know, it is interesting because, like, watching it this time, you know, I've seen it innumerable times, but I was paying a lot more attention to sort of like the Batman arc, if there is one in the movie. Mm-hmm. And it is interesting that he is flat-footed for the majority of this movie when it comes to like, he is getting outwitted almost at every turn. And he's the big hero at the end. He obviously saves Gotham from the Penguin army and he saves the children from their untimely death at the hands of Penguin. So like he is the big hero at the end, but it doesn't feel particularly triumphant or victorious in a way that I feel like the whole movie is so muted. Like one of the big things as I was doing some research on it, just about like, it's clear Tim Burton didn't really want to do this movie. Like, he felt like, you know, it was a huge success and I'm sure he was happy for all the doors that it opened for him. It allowed him to make Edward Scissorhands. It allowed him to make Nightmare Before Christmas and his brand was evolving. And I think he was just sort of like, why am I going to do this? And then basically they were like, you could do anything you want. And he was like, okay, I'm going to make the antithetical studio movie that no one really wants to get made. And I think that that's kind of why it feels like a lot of like, thumbing people in the eye and kind of doing shit because he can get away with doing it.
Yeah. It's also, though, you look at it from our perspective now at the end of this, or what seems like the end of whatever wave of superhero movies that the last 15 years has had. And this movie is in possession of like every single thing that we complain about superhero movies losing or not having. We're like, it's funny, it's horny, it's idiosyncratic, it's sort of, you know, it's very much an auteurist, you know, movie where like it's not a, it's, you know, there are no corporate concerns, really, or if there are, they're being completely overridden. Yeah. It's everything that we look at now and we wish superhero movies were. And it's funny to think that back then, like, even critics were being like, this movie spends too much time on character building. And now it's just sort of just like, now it's just like, you know, it's amazing to imagine, you know, a critic talking about that, where it's just like, this movie could use a little more fight scenes for the kids and stuff like that. It's like, oh, okay. Well, like,
yeah. This is sort of a question for everybody, but I feel like the equivalent today, is it Todd Phillips' Joker? I mean, is that kind of...
I actually have an answer to this. I think the 2023, the Batman, 2022, the Batman, is the perfect Venn diagram intersection of this movie and David Fincher. Like, it is doing, that movie is one I've seen like a dozen times. I love that movie. I can like, it's a comfort watch for me in a weird way.
Interesting.
In the same way that Zodiac is.
I want to revisit it.
I really like it on streaming a lot. Like, I liked it in the theater a lot, but like on streaming, you can just kind of pause it whenever. It's just like,
it's a million hours long, I'm sure.
Yeah, I sort of agree that it's too long. And I also am kind of like, this is a little too short. This could be like 6 hours longer. I just want to hang out here.
I like, want the Penguin.
That is,
there's not enough HBO of Max. Colin Farrell going, what do you want? I'm a guy.
That is a movie that takes the dreadful self-seriousness of Nolan. And I like those Nolan movies. I think The Dark Knight's pretty fantastic. I like Batman Begins a lot. Dark Knight Rises is a mess, but a fun mess.
Yeah. I think it is a fun mess. I agree with you there. Yeah.
But like, and then this, especially the Zack Snyder read on Batman, and it tries to introduce a little bit more of this horniness. Zoe Kravitz is so hot in that movie. And it tries to introduce a little bit more of the goofiness. And it also it pulls from Fincher the detective thing. To me, that's like the closest we've come, but it's nowhere near like this movie's weird, mournful. Like,
no. But I also feel like, I mean, I didn't hate The Batman. I thought it was long in the theater, and I've wanted to rewatch it for what it's worth. I think there's a lot of stuff that it should be my favorite movie ever, but ultimately it's not. So I don't know what that says. Mm-hmm. But
I'm not a giant fan of that movie either. Yeah.
You're all going to come around by the end of this podcast. That's my mission.
It's funny that you mentioned like the detective thing, because like, yes, except like that's maybe my main hang up in the movie, is that like all the detective stuff I think is really bad in that movie.
I think I think like within if I'm tracking the reality of that movie's detective story, and I totally buy that like Batman doesn't get it, but the audience gets there so far ahead of him.
So far ahead.
I want to give a little bit of context for Batman Returns for the people that don't know what happens in Batman Returns. The monstrous penguin, played by Danny DeVito, who lives in the sewers beneath Gotham, joins up with wicked, shock-headed businessman Max Schreck, played by Christopher Walken, to topple the Batman, played by Michael Keaton, once and for all. But when Schreck's timid assistant, Selina Kyle, played by Michelle Pfeiffer, finds out and Schreck tries to kill her, she's transformed into the sexy Catwoman. She teams up with the penguin and Schreck to destroy Batman, but sparks fly unexpectedly when she confronts the Caped Crusader. Batman Returns opened on June 18th, 1992, against Sister Act, House Sitter, Lethal Weapon 3, Far and Away, and the Mighty Ducks.
Some of these box office like weekends, honestly,
is that
to God,
not crazy?
Are we doing Lethal Weapon 3? Because like, I have never seen a Lethal Weapon, so it feels like I should probably start with Lethal Weapon 3.
Yeah, the PG-13 one is the one you should start with.
Yeah.
I think I've mentioned on your podcast before, one version of this podcast, the VHS tape I had taped off of a HBO free preview weekend that had Sister Act and House Sitter on it that I would watch.
So you were there.
Constantly. Mm-hmm. Just absolutely constantly. I loved those two movies.
I mean,
so
justice
much.
For House Sitter.
I love House Sitter. House Sitter is a genuinely underrated
House
movie.
Sitter rules.
I've never seen House Sitter, so we'll be covering
it. Line it up.
We'll line it up. But it is one of those. I mean, this is, we're smack dab in the summer, so obviously this is, you know, big time for Hollywood, but still, like, the spectrum of what you're getting at the theaters, as we've discussed on many occasions on this podcast, in 92 trumps even honestly what you were getting in 99 when we did that podcast. Like, it really does feel like we're at a real kind of fulcrum point for Hollywood where you're getting a ton of shit, which slowly dissipates as you get deeper into the 90s. But this movie would go on to make $266 million on a $60 million budget. There's different numbers floating around on this budget. Could be 80, could be 60. it made a profit.
Just just to return to House Sitter for a second.
Please.
Yeah. Yes.
I've never seen it. That said, I was like hanging out with some friends the week, like shortly after both of these movies came out. Mm-hmm. And one of my friends had seen both. And he was like, Batman Returns is a huge, he was like Gene Shell. He was like, Batman Returns is a huge disappointment. Tim Burton lets the fans down. House Sitter, though, is a new classic.
Half of that statement is correct.
For real?
Yeah.
That's incredible. Batman Returns has 81% on Rotten Tomatoes from critics, 73% from audiences. Roger Ebert gave the film 2 stars. Tim Burton's Batman Returns, even more than the original Batman, is a dark, brooding film filled with hurt and fear, childhood wounds, and festering adult resentments. It's also a most intriguing movie, great to look at, fun to talk about. There's no doubt Burton is a gifted director, but is he the right director for Batman? The film opens in cruelty and shame as parents of a deformed baby put him in a bassinet and drop him into the river of a cold, snowy Christmas night. I give the movie a negative review, and yet I don't think it's a bad movie. It's more of a misguided one made with great creativity, but denying us what we more or less deserve Batman's story. Looking back over both films, I think Burton has a vision here and is trying to shape it to the material, but it just won't fit. No matter how hard you try, superheroes and film noir don't go together. Amazing. He clearly does not know where
the genre is going.
I mean, like, toward the end of his life, like, Roger Ebert and I emailed several times, and like, he had very firm ideas of what a superhero movie should be that just never lined up with like
what do you think that comes from?
I think that maybe when he was a kid, you know, he had very like, he's coming of age at a time when, like, God, when he was a teenager and a college student at the age, like when Stan Lee and Jack Kirby were changing Marvel. So, like, I wonder if he has kind of this idea of, like, these should be aimed at, you know, 5 to 16-year-olds.
He does have one other line in the review that I need to read, where he says, Batman and Catwoman's few erotic moments together are, alas, so incomplete and unsatisfying, look like they might have been trimmed for a PG-13 rating. All right, Roger. So, yeah. What are you getting at exactly? You think that this shit went farther, but they felt like they needed to cut it back? It's not horny enough for you?
He thinks Tim Burton's like sitting on a reel of some real, real explicit Batman Catwoman scenes. That
the denied gratification of those erotic scenes, denied gratification is the point of those scenes.
Correct.
I bet, though, there is like 5 more minutes that is like just cornier enough that it like went over the line.
Sure. And, yeah. I mean, when she licks him, it's incredible. Like, it is.
Oh, yes.
God bless this movie. I mean,
you can also imagine that there's a threesome cut of this movie somewhere where Batman and Penguin and Catwoman do what we all would were expecting.
And
where
Batman expect is in the middle.
We all know.
See his French flipper trick.
We've all read the stories about how this film's original cut had full frontal scenes for both Michael Keaton and Danny DeVito. That was just too much.
Yeah.
I got to tell you.
Squaresville, America, in 92 couldn't handle it. Yeah.
The Penguins, I guess, onesie doesn't leave much to the imagination.
It sure doesn't.
You think there's another flipper?
that's how you know it's a Christmas movie. He's in a union suit.
That's true. That's a good point. Okay, at the end.
Yes.
Not to like skip ahead.
We'll jump around, of course, yeah.
Does he die of not being able to get back into the water? If he had made it back into the water, would he have been able? Is he like that much of an aquatic creature that he needs to replenish his?
I always took it as, and again, this is me reading into it because it's a little loosey-goosey with this stuff, but it feels as though there is toxic waste and whatnot in the water.
Yeah, that makes
sense.
So
I'm wondering if he's poisoned in some way by what's in the water.
Lifelong mercury poisoning from eating all of the toxic fish.
See, this is what Jeremy Piven was talking about that one time. So, you know.
Exactly.
Have you ever seen the Kevin Smith movie Tusk? I feel like that explains all your answers.
It actually does. It explains everything. All the problems with this movie. You know, I do think that it is interesting. When I was talking with Daniel Waters about sort of, there's a bunch of scripts, right? Like, this starts with a Sam Hamm draft. It goes to Daniel Waters, who kind of throws away a lot of Sam Hamm's draft. does his own, and then Wesley Strick is brought in to sort of streamline and kind of make it quote unquote lighter. I don't know. So I do think that, and from Daniel's words, it sounds like Wesley was the one who added a lot of the horny stuff in there, which I think is interesting. I wouldn't have thought that, but it does feel like if you actually did board out this script, you'd have a lot of questions. You'd definitely be like, motives and why people are doing what they're doing. But
I like, again, to be clear, I really do respect and like this movie. I don't know why there's like a weird business intrigue politics plot just sort of grafted onto everything else. I love Penguin Running for Mayor. I love Penguin Running for Mayor. The Max Schreck stuff. I love Max Schreck as a character, but the like business machinations, and we're going to like have this guy take over his man. And like my favorite line in the movie is, Penguin's like, isn't the election in November and it's December? Like, and Max Schreck's like, don't worry about it. But yeah, there like that element of it is just like, I don't quite know what we're doing here, everybody.
It does.
Some of us are more interested in power plant politics than the rest of us.
This movie takes place in like the span of a week.
That's crazy, you know? Too. Like the time compression on it is, he becomes, there's a full fledged mayoral campaign that like, is lives and dies, over the course of like a week.
That's perfect. Okay, I'm coming around. It's perfect.
No.
See,
story tone.
I do think though that one of the things this time around that kind of jumped out at me is the Selena Max relationship, and how, I hate to say progressive or sort of, you know, feminist that storyline is, and how it speaks in 2023 even more loudly than maybe it did in 1992. And I do think that her, like their arc, I found really fascinating. I love, you know, the final confrontation that she has with him, that she literally kills him with a kiss. It all feels really sort of as though they really cared about that. Do you know what I mean? Like of sort of everything in the movie, Selena Kyle and Catwoman is clearly the thing that they feel the most interested.
That's the real climax of the end of the movie is her and Max, much more so than Batman and Penguin.
Correct.
Well, because Max Schreck is the real villain. I mean, they're all, this is the first Batman movie to have three villains in it. But Max Schreck is, in the emotional arc of this movie, the true villain of the piece. And you know, because that's the thing about the Batman villains, going forward in at least the 90s movies, is that all of these villains are kind of deeply sympathetic in some type of way. I mean, the Penguin, probably the most sympathetic, this tragic character who's essentially destroyed by, you know, what happens to him in infancy. But, you know, if the A story, I think, of this movie, like the first, like, most important story is the Penguin's mayoral campaign, basically. And then maybe the B/C story is Selena and Bruce. But then, yes, that other one is Max and Selena.
Well, because the Penguin story is kind of twofold, right? It is the mayoral campaign, but when everything is said and done, it's really about him wanting to kill all the firstborns.
Yeah.
Right. Well, here's
Christmas.
The thing.
You know, for kids.
We talk about these sort of eras of Batman as being very distinct from each other, the Burtons and the Schumachers and the Nolans and the Zack Snyders and whatnot. And yet Batman Returns is the one that feels like it has some sort of connective tissue to the Nolans in a few ways, in the sort of like the darkness of it, but also like the Nolan movies imperfectly, I would say, at least sort of bring a kind of capitalist critique or, you know,
Gotham
some sort
politics.
Of angle to it. Yeah. Right. And this one, it's interesting to see back in 92. And I don't think that like Tim Burton was too terribly interested in like the politics of capitalism. And yet like Catwoman's clearly an anarchist and Penguin is very much looking to like strike a blow against the wealthy fat cats and whatever. And the like entrenched, you know, oligarchy that's happening
retribution.
In Gotham. And like Max Schreck is like the most capitalism with a capital C sort of character. And then you just get all of this. And like Batman then is sort of in this uncomfortable position as always of just like, Well, I'd agree with you, except for all these millions of dollars that I'm sort of sitting on. I'm like, I want to do the right thing, but also, like, you know that I'm like one of the good, I'm like the good billionaire and whatever. And
yeah, it makes me think of like the fishy soie moment where I'm like, where you're just like, okay, so Bruce doesn't know that fishy soie is supposed to be cold.
Right.
Is that supposed to make us like him?
Guys. Yeah.
Yeah.
He's just like you. He doesn't like cold potato soup either. It's fine. He thinks the rich are ostentatious. Yeah.
I heard fishy soie, and I was like, is that the scene where Penguin just eats a raw fish in front of everybody? Because I like that. That's good.
By the way,
that is also supposed to be cold, sir.
Penguin is a truly revolting character from, like...
I respect the hustle. I do.
Oh, yeah.
I do, too. But every time I watch it, there are moments where I'm just like, he's just trying to gross us out, right?
He's
like,
so gross.
He's just zooming into the Penguin's disgusting mouth just to rub our faces in how disgusting this man is. The Penguin eating that fish and sucking back like this chunk of fish guts into his mouth.
But they had no time to take Oswald to the dentist. They were running a mayoral campaign in under a week.
I'll say, go ahead, Emily.
If we're doing a fuck, marry, kill on the villains in this movie, I'm marrying Penguin. I'm marrying Penguin every day.
You're killing Batman?
I'm killing Shrek. I'm killing Max Shrek.
On the villain. Yeah,
I'm going to fuck Catwoman. I don't want to tie her down. I think she deserves better than me.
See, but in that way, that's why I'm marrying her, because like we can have an arrangement. You know what I mean? Whereas I think one wild night with the Penguin is maybe all I need with the Penguin. You know what I mean?
Like, more stability.
The Penguin at least has a plan. Catwoman's just kind of...
I also have to say, as repulsed by the Penguin as I might very well be, he might be great in bed. He seems to talk about it a lot. He seems to...
I buy it. I think he's... Yeah. I would have his babies. I think they would be beautiful.
Yeah, what are baby penguins called? We should figure that out. That's a good question.
Let me see if I can find that. I think.
Yeah, I guess. Imagine. Yeah, maybe it's just that simple. But the thing about Burton is, and much as like, and I love all the Burton movies that everybody loves, and I don't talk about all the Burton movies that nobody talks about. There is some degree with Burton of, I'm such an outsider. Nobody understands me. My hair is all weird. You know what I mean? Yeah. It's just like the Edward Scissorhands. And I love Edward Scissorhands. Trust me.
Sure.
But that feels like, Edward Scissorhands is such an outcast. He has this like, angelic face and is, is sweet and whatever.
And he's a hot guy.
Whereas like with Penguin, the one thing that I really love about Penguin is Burton really does make the case for like, did this guy ever really have a chance? Because nobody wants to look at him because he's so repulsive. And like, that is human nature in a nutshell, is just like, there are some people who are so outside the boundaries of like what we deem as acceptable to look at that, like, that they are just outside of the norm. And like, there is a way of reading that as Penguin. It's just like, Penguin never had a shot. You know what I mean? Penguin was dumped into the river, and that's
Hear that. I mean, think it's funny. I just rewatched relatively recently Benjamin Button, because Blank Check was covering Fincher, and then I just was watching Dead Ringers, the TV show, and it feels like there's a lot of unwanted children, weird kind of baby things in both of those films, obviously. And this movie, obviously opens with the birth of Oswald Cobblepot. We never see baby Penguin. We just see him in a metal cage and eating a cat.
Yeah, okay, fair. He does eat a cat. Yeah.
So we don't.
The baby. He doesn't know.
Sustenance. You got to just like my
He's
baby.
He's just relying on instinct.
My baby will eat whatever you stick in front of him.
Whatever. Yeah. I mean, there's a great thing that apparently when Danny DeVito was apprehensive about taking the role, he met with Burton, and Burton had painted this painting, which subsequently I think has been printed in some of his books, of this little diminutive character sitting on a red and white striped ball with the caption, "My name is Jimmy, but my friends call me the hideous penguin boy." And that was what got DeVito to sign on. So, I mean, it does feel like they were on the same wavelength. And by the way, like, Danny DeVito's comedy is notoriously very pitch black comedies.
Oh,
not
yeah.
a surprise that he would gravitate towards this.
I think we're talking about like a lot of like the capitalism angle, the sexual harassment angle. This is all stuff that like people were interested in at mm-hmm. this time. Sexual harassment especially was like a new topic that was like new in the news, and people were like, sometimes you shouldn't make a woman sleep with you to give her a promotion. That's bad. And people were like, no, it's not. It's fine. That's the way things work. But like,
and then Clinton is like,
I think what's like really fascinating is the writers of this film and the actors of this film are all very interested in that stuff. And Tim Burton knows enough to get out of its way, but he could not care less about any of it. He's just kind of like, he just like, he's interested in, I think this is my Tim Burton problem. He's interested in freaks and outsiders, but not in any sort of systemic way. He's interested in them as like, you know, like individuals who like exist outside the system, and the problem, you know, the problem is like with the system, but the system only has to like warp enough to let them in. It's, I don't know. I find him very tiring. I like a lot of his movies. This one's probably my favorite of his. So
just before we continue, baby penguins are called chicks or nestlings. Just FYI.
Thank you.
Nestlings, very cute.
It is.
Chris, I didn't mean to cut you off.
Oswald Nestling Cup. Well, no, I mean, you could even apply that to the penguin, and this is kind of an extension of some of the other things we were saying, is like the penguin kidnaps Max Schreck, blackmails him about the toxic waste, but Max Schreck basically immediately gets the upper hand, and it uses Penguin as a pawn for his own means in the end, and like flips that immediately.
I want to do kind of a Tim Burton deep dive here for a second, because I do think it's worth examining. Like, I grew up as a big Tim Burton fan. He's obviously a big influence. Obviously, Sleepy Hollow was a very big movie for me and was obviously hugely influential in me creating a show called Sleepy Hollow. I do feel like...
Oh, they were about the same thing?
Yeah, I know. Crazy, right? I do think that he's continually, and more times than not, probably fairly maligned for being style over substance, right? He clearly is a guy who is much more interested in in visuals and in sort of production design and costumes, and just sort of, he clearly loves movie making. Mm-hmm. But I don't know that he necessarily likes to dig particularly deep under the surface.
Yeah. Yeah. He came up through the world of animation, and like animation, of course, you can create beautiful, heart-stopping masterpieces, but like animation is so visually driven. And I think it is a space where people who don't ultimately have an interest in like the realities of human life can like sort of flourish. You know, obviously I'm, you know, Miyazaki and some of those folks like are telling great stories within that medium that are about human reality, but like if you have a unique design sensibility, you can skate by on a lot there. And also, to be fair to Tim Burton, if a piano had fallen on him in 2004, his reputation would be so much better right now.
Yeah.
You know? Yes.
I mean, fair.
Well, that's one thing that is, I think, ultimately so depressing about where his career has gone, is that even if you just say the style over substance type of thing, and, you know, you're just someone who likes him for the aesthetic experience, or you are okay with him just being a visual artist. Mm-hmm. The unfortunate thing is when the movies get bad, they also get ugly. So
do.
It's like even his rely so much on aesthetics, he's giving you an aesthetic you don't want.
Well, I think it's tapping into the technology angle, which is the problem too, which is that at a certain point, it becomes unfeasible for a filmmaker who loved tactility and loved to build things to actually get to do that, right? Like, I think the fulcrum point for him in a lot of ways is Mars Attacks, which he notoriously wanted the aliens to be stop motion. And then the studio was like, we're not doing that.
Yeah.
Take a look at special effects. It can do what you want to do. And he looked at them. He's like, yeah, actually, I'm okay with this. And that was the beginning of the end, because it's just like...
I think there is nobody, no filmmaker in Hollywood who has been more hurt by digital color grading, which is like a huge problem for a lot of filmmakers. But like Burton... Big Fish looks really beautiful. That's digitally graded, like, really well. And then he's just kind of like, everything looks the same. And you're like, okay, it's, I think he's been just decimated by that.
I want to sort of, I think it's also worth noting, there's two things. The first is the movies that he loves, the filmmakers that he loves, are not of sort of, he loves B movies. He grew up on like shitty B movies in Burbank, right? Like, so, and I don't mean shitty, but I just mean, you know, disposable, I guess, to some degree. So he's never been a guy, from what I've read anyway, that's really gravitated towards like things of real depth. Like, he's just a filmmaker that likes, you know, popcorn movies, right? Like, he loved those old 3D movies from that time. And I think if you look at his filmography, it's just, it's all there. It's just, that's kind of it. Like, that's all he really wants to talk about. And
yet, when his movies were really hitting, he was able to, it's not like it's smoke and mirrors. It's not like, you know, Pee-wee and Beetlejuice and Edward Scissorhands and those movies are smoke and mirrors, but he's able to get just enough of a kind of universal sort of broad strokes characterization of these, you know, outcasts and whatever. It's not like Beetlejuice goes particularly deep on Lydia's sort of character. And yet by the end of that movie, you feel really triumphant that she's able to, like, you know, whatever, she got an A on the test and she's floating up to the ceiling with Barbara and Adam or whatever. And you're happy that she's found some version of like parents who she likes to be around and like that kind of thing. And Pee-wee, you know, certainly, you know, it's easy to get invested in that kind of thing. And it's, I think it is a matter of like the less tactile the aesthetics are able to be, he does lose, you know, maybe it's not a surprise that you sort of lose that ability to also, you know, get just enough of a character. I think his most sort of character focused movie is probably Ed Wood. Mm-hmm. And that's maybe a movie that you really can look and like, you really see where he does pour all of that, you know, that actual like narrative focus into. But there is a way when in those early movies of just you do get something out of those. You do get something on a character level,
sure,
you know, out of those movies. And I think you get a little bit of that in Batman Returns with Catwoman, certainly, and with, I think I would say, also Penguin. This was a movie I was always a person, predictably, who, you know, was sort of just like all about Catwoman. And then like DeVito's Penguin, I could sort of take or leave. And watching it this time was probably the first time I really had an appreciation for what DeVito's doing with the movie and what Burton's doing with that character. So
I feel like it's worth noting, because I do think that the reason that Ed Wood is sort of, I would imagine, universally kind of pointed to as his best film is because, A, it's a love letter to everything he loves about movies, right? Like, it is everything Tim Burton there, right, on its face. He doesn't have to rely on any of the sort of usual tricks of the things that he does. It's just a really beautiful character study about loving movies, right? Like, and that's why it works. And then I would also argue that Sleepy Hollow, which is sort of the last real kind of tactile movie, like, sound stages and like building shit, it's kind of the last one for him. That movie feels also like it's a nod to those Hammer films that he loved as a kid. Like, it's that kind of stuff that I think works well for him, and then he just drops the ball.
You wouldn't call out Planet of the Apes, because that
would not.
I think that Ed Wood is probably Ed Wood or Batman Returns are my favorites.
And like
but I do think, like, I think a lot about one of the types of filmmaker I tend to bounce off of is a filmmaker who tends to make movies assembled out of other movies. Like, Edgar Wright is someone I just am not on the wavelength of. I love Tarantino, and I think that, but I think that what's interesting about Tarantino, and that maybe is like an interesting comparison point to Tim Burton, is Tarantino feels like he continues to watch every movie and he's pulling them all in and he's reassembling them in his head. I'm not sure Tim Burton watches movies anymore. I think he just kind of has his idea of what a movie is and he just keeps making it.
I do think that, you know, all of the knocks against Tim Burton, he deserves. You know, the last 10 years have not been particularly kind to him, 10, 15 years at this point.
Yeah.
I think that I mean, I kind of ride for Dumbo. I kind of enjoyed that movie.
It's fine.
It was, I mean, it's certainly a high point for him, but I want to ask Joe and Chris about Tim Burton and Oscars, because I do think that there are movies he's made specifically, I want to say Big Eyes, I want to say Big Fish, you know, the big movies
the
he's
big
made.
Movies, yes.
That feel very kind of like, even Sweeney Todd feels a little bit like Oscar Beatty. I mean,
yeah.
I mean, I feel like Sweeney Todd was the last hurrah for Tim Burton doing anything
decent
beyond surface level. And like, that movie has problems, but it really feels like the last time Tim Burton made a movie. You know, where it, you know, he doesn't feel checked out. And I think some of that maybe has to do with the creative risk that he is taking, and him being someone who doesn't make musicals, making a musical, the risk of casting people who can't sing in your musical. But no, I mean, I think just some of the visual storytelling of that movie, I would go to bat for.
I really like that movie.
Yeah, I do too.
But
Big Eyes,
that...
Big Eyes is an interesting one. We did our episode on that one, and that's one where I think that's where the last sort of Burton true believers really had their hearts broken. Where if you were hoping that Burton had one more sort of like crack at respectability, almost like in him, it's not like respectability needs to be the be all and end all, but like there's nothing to it. Like it's such a weird movie.
It's like, almost more emblematic of his limitations as a filmmaker than say something like Alice in Wonderland.
Right.
Because it is ultimately at the end of the day, a human drama. And like, you could almost kind of starkly compare it to Ed Wood, because they're both movies about real people, but Ed Wood is the stronger movie. And I think it's because it's about characters he can relate to and that he personally kind of cares about, and he is invested in those people's artistry. And like Tim Burton, the artist who Amy Adams plays, I forget the woman's name,
Margaret
She was an artist that he did actually love and care about, but like, she's a painter, he's a filmmaker, you know.
Of course, loved
Wood
her art. She painted exclusively children with giant eyes. Like, there's no more target audience for that than
she brought him into corporate reality.
Yeah,
I do think though, to your point though, if you're putting those two films next to each other, Big Eyes is a oddly sort of nuanced movie about art versus artist, and like sort of the intrinsic values that come with that, and it's a moral quandary in a lot of ways. That is not what I go to Tim Burton for. That isn't like, it's not his strong suit.
Well, I mean, I think the reason why it's emblematic of a lot of his problems and like his limitations, the things he doesn't do well in movies, is more just the simple human drama of it. You don't watch that movie and care enough about these characters, you know. It's a pretty clear cut, you know, narrative arc, and I think the level of story investment, it's lacking. And it's, even when it's, you know, it's fine in that movie, you know, its best moments, it never really rises to what it should, just at a base level.
I mean, I guess, you know, Emily, I'm curious as to your thoughts on like what, I mean, I guess the question, you know, we have Beetlejuice 2 to look forward to next year, guys. So that's coming, whether we like it or not. But I do wonder, like, do you think there's a third act in Tim Burton's career, or do you think we're just...
I mean, he's nominated for 2 Emmys this year for Wednesday. So they should have called Beetlejuice 2 Tootlejuice. Is what they should have done.
Be Tootlejuice.
I can't believe they didn't go Hawaiian after all these years.
Listen, I do think that he has hooked up with Jenna Ortega, who seems to hate working with him, but continues to. And like, I feel like that could be a rich relationship for him. Because like,
I just hope he doesn't start dating her, because it seems like that seems
I have a like, lot of faith in Jenna Ortega. Not, like,
I mean, I had faith in Ava Green too.
I think that I think Jenna Ortega is a very fun young presence, and I think that she kind of fits his aesthetic well. And I can see a world where he lets himself be challenged to like make something good for her, but it looks like he's just going to cast her as like the daughters of people from previous movies.
She's just his new Winona Ryder.
That's yeah, exactly.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, I don't know if anything will come of any of this, but I just think that his career is fascinating. I think there's a reason why people still love his stuff. It's mostly because of the stuff he made prior to 1996. But, you know, those things, those flags are planted pretty deep, as we talk about with this movie.
I mean, like, I do always forget that, like, Sweeney Todd, which is probably in my top, it's definitely my top 10, might be in my top five. It's like 2007. Like, he was, and this is another thing I was thinking about, is the best thing that happened to Batman Returns was weirdly The Dark Knight, because the big thing that overhung this movie for a long time was that no one's as good as Nicholson. Nicholson is the perfect Batman villain. Joker's such a titanic performance in the history of popcorn cinema, blah, blah, blah. And then Heath Ledger comes along and is now like sort of the definitive Joker. And we've had like 16 definitive Jokers at this point.
I was going to say, it at least opened the door for the fact that like you could have multiple definitive Jokers. Yeah.
Yeah. So that opened up a lot of room for DeVito, especially. Obviously, people loved Catwoman at the time this movie was released. But like, I think that DeVito was held up to the Jack Nicholson standard when he's doing something very different. And I think that Heath Ledger
got a Razzie nomination,
which is insane.
Yeah, he's amazing.
He's amazing. And
that's the thing I'm talking about too. Just like, it's easy to look at this movie and be like, Penguin is such a gross character. I don't want to see that. Razzie nomination. And the Razzies are lowest common denominator. So the thing that I think is more outrageous is, of the five Saturn nominations that this movie got, Michelle Pfeiffer wasn't one of them. What are five genre performances that year by actresses that are better than Pfeiffer in this movie? Like, what the fuck are we doing here,
guys? Oh my God.
This movie is...
They nominated seven performances that
year. Who were they?
Okay. And like, all right. Most of these are good. They're just outside of their... Okay. Sure. Virginia Madsen and Candyman wins. That's kind of a rad win. I like that.
Yeah, that's good.
Sure. She's great in that. Yeah.
Marilyn Death Becomes Her. No problems with
that. Sure.
Aaron Stone and Basic Instinct. Incredible. Rebecca De Mornay in Hand That Rocks the Cradle. A fun performance, not better than what Pfeiffer is giving in Batman Returns. Sigourney in Alien 3. Mm-hmm. Sure. It's Sigourney. It's Ripley. That's right. Cheryl Lee in Twin Peaks Fire Walk With Me.
Yes.
And then
number one,
Winona Ryder in Bram Stoker's Dracula. Lord knows there are a few people who love Bram Stoker's Dracula better than me. I'm not like that performance ahead of Pfeiffer as Catwoman is objectively insane.
I mean, Rebecca's the most glaring to me.
Yeah, I could have bumped either of those two. Like Michelle Pfeiffer should absolutely be in there.
A space. Yeah.
Yeah. Exactly. I mean, here's a question to you guys, and maybe this is me showing, you know, my love for this performance too much, but like, if Michelle Pfeiffer put in this performance today, I think people would like talk about her for an Oscar nomination.
Yes, they would.
They would. Unfortunately, this is the year she's nominated for Love Field, correct?
A movie I've never seen.
Yeah. It's a horrible movie, and she's not good in it. And originally, Age of Innocence was also supposed to come out in 92.
It was supposed to come out at the end of 92, but it got pushed to 93.
Yeah. So, especially if you would have had in the universe that exists where both of these movies come out in the same year, I mean. Wow.
Yeah, there's much less of a taboo these days about like talking about an action superhero movie in terms of performance quality. And because even at the time, it's not like it took a while for people to come around on that being a great performance. The reviews, it was the one thing most critics liked about the movie was Pfeiffer's performance. And then as the years went on, it just became more and more beloved, and as the years have gone on, now you look back and you're just like, man, like we maybe lost our moment with Pfeiffer, you know what I mean? Like passed, and it's like it's too bad, because you look at that and it's just like she wasn't going to beat Emma Thompson for Howard's End. Nobody was beating Emma Thompson for Howard's End that year, but like, you know, that would have been a really kind of like groundbreaking nomination.
I bet she could have beat Marissa Tomei for supporting actress.
Oh,
I bet
if they that could have happened.
Well, yeah, yeah. Supporting.
Yeah, they probably would have pushed a performance like this into supporting.
That's true.
Yeah.
That's true. That's a very good point. Yeah.
I want to talk about Pfeiffer for a second because I do feel like, I mean, this is my favorite Pfeiffer performance, but like it's neck and neck with Fabulous Baker Boys because I think both of those performances are just unbelievable. And I do feel like Hollywood kind of, I don't want to say didn't know what to do with her, but like she's a prime example of being too beautiful for her own good. And I think the critics tending to be like, yeah, she's pretty, but can she really act? And like every time she gives you a performance far better than the that she's being given. And I just think it is one of those things where like she obviously Grease 2, Scarface, Lady Hawk, Witches of Eastwick. She's amazing in Married to the Mob. Yes. Dangerous Liaison, you know, Fabulous Baker Boys, Frankie and Johnny, The Russia House. Like these are all just kind of like anonymous movies that don't really exist.
We got to do The Russia
Frankie
House.
Frankie and Johnny is a better movie than it has any right to be.
The Russia House, did that have Oscar buzz?
Russia House definitely had Oscar buzz. It was a Golden Globe nominee, I'm pretty sure, for something.
Okay.
Frankie and Johnny, I will agree, Chris, we did an episode on that a while back. Better than it has any right to be. She's great in it. And there's a Barbara Walters interview that she does around that time promoting that movie that is worth looking up on YouTube because Barbara really tries to hang on her this idea that she's too aloof to for her own good, kind of, and that she's, you know, icy and Pfeiffer is
Barbara wants her to tap dance, basically.
Pfeiffer is having none of it. It's the most confrontational interview that doesn't involve any kind of like actual like fighting. It's so
no, I'm definitely watching.
Like Pfeiffer is the claws are the claw. It's not even like it's not catty. It's she is just ceding absolutely no ground, and it's wonderful to watch. It's really something.
But it's you know, you mentioned, Joe, this idea of like, did we opportunity or did it sort of, you know, did the career that could have been get away from her? Because it does feel like you got Batman Returns and Love Field. She gets another nomination for Love Field. Age of Innocence is 93. Then you got Wolf. You like Wolf, Emily?
I just saw Wolf for the first time recently. Oh, what a weird movie.
That is a movie. The same kid who was like House Sitter, a new classic, loved Wolf. So
there you go.
There you go.
Nice.
They just let them make that movie. That weird movie.
That movie is bizarre.
I like Wolf.
I'm like 95% sure that this is true. The VHS box for Wolf had half of each of their faces on either side. And so if you lined them up at Blockbuster together, you would have half of Nicholson's face. Because like, and I think if you could like flip the box over and you could do half of Nicholson's face and half of Pfeiffer's face, like right next to each other. And it was like super weird.
That's the beginning of the end for her. I mean, not to say that she doesn't make movies that make money. Dangerous Minds makes money. You know what I mean? Like, One Fine Day is a cute movie.
Dangerous Minds was nominated for the best movie at the MTV Movie Awards that year, so there is that.
That tracks. But it's like, you know, Up Close and Personal. You know, obviously, Emily, we talked about Story of Us.
Right? Yeah, Story of Us, absolutely one of the best films.
Up Close and Personal wasn't it was marginally successful, but the song... the soundtrack was big.
Yeah.
I mean, like, I think really one of the things is like she gets into a zone where she starts starring in these adaptations of big like books, and some of it, like White Oleander is a pretty good movie, and like
she's great in it.
And it's just like, but like these movies end up feeling they fall into like the gap where the 90s and 2000s were not kind to women directors, and she worked with a lot of women directors or people who were directing films based on books written by women. And like that tends
to
like
to the ocean.
Yeah. So like, and like some of those movies are good, like White Oleander, and like White Oleander should have been an Oscar player and it just wasn't. Yeah.
She was nominated for the SAG award, I want to say. Like she came close.
Yeah. But, and then she takes like 4 years off, and that I think just totally.
Well, she wants to raise her kids, which is
to be married to David E. Kelly and raise her kids, which is fine.
Multi-millionaire. Yeah, I want to talk about her as Catwoman because this is probably in my top five favorite performances ever. I just absolutely adore her in this movie. I think that she is so like wickedly funny and unbelievably sexy, and just I don't know. It is one of those, like, talking to Daniel about, you know, the potential of a Catwoman movie that almost happened, you know, that Burton wanted to do it, but that it was, I mean, the way he describes it in our interview is, I mean, basically like a black and white, like, she moves to a small town, and he wanted it to be like this pastiche of all these like old kind of B movie, kind of pinup girl, black sort of dominatrix kind of, I don't know. It doesn't sound like a movie that was ever going to get made.
Would watch.
But I just, yeah, I would watch. I mean, obviously I'd watch it, but I do think that, you know, all things considered, Annette Bening was supposed to be the role. She was cast in the role. She got pregnant, bowed out of the role.
Sean Young goes on daytime TV.
Sean Young loses her freaking mind and like goes to Warner Brothers, sneaks onto the studio, gets into his office. Tim Burton talks about hiding under his desk, like just weird shit.
Who hasn't hidden under their desk?
From Sean Young? Yeah. But this is all to say, like, when Annette Bening bows out, this role becomes a free-for-all, right? Like, every woman in the certain age bracket wanted this. I just can't. I mean, I think Annette Bening would have actually been good in this. I think that
Grifter's era Annette Bening.
I was going to say Grifter's era Annette Bening, Bugsy era Annette Bening. That works. That tracks. Yeah.
I think 100%.
I think she would have been great.
Yeah.
And she has that kind of feline features to her that obviously Michelle does as well. But like, how could I? It's hard to visualize anyone else other than Michelle Pfeiffer in this role.
Yeah.
Some of the research I did, apparently she was up for Vicki Vale in the first Batman. And he tells Warner Brothers or Burton to not cast Michelle Pfeiffer because they had dated at one point and he was trying to reconcile with
Keaton
his wife.
Said this?
Keaton said this.
Okay.
So Keaton was like, you can't cast her in this. So then I guess by this point, his marriage was kaput and he could care less.
He was free as a bird now. Yeah, that's fine.
Better for Pfeiffer, though, because Pfeiffer at that point, why the hell would she want to play Vicki Vale? 100%. Like,
yeah.
Totally.
Yeah.
I do love how this movie like gives a little like coda to the Vicki Vale story where like Alfred like accidentally let her into the Batcave or whatever. And like
that's such a throwaway.
That was the end of that. There's a moment. The moment where she's comes like flipping end over end over end over end and she lands right in front of Batman and Penguin, and it's the moment that was in all of the trailers, right, where she just goes meow, right? And but if you watch it in the context of the actual movie scene, she gives this look of like, oh, what am I supposed to say, something like, yeah, okay, like meow, like whatever. And it's like and it's just that little bit of difference that is so fucking funny.
It's the best.
And it's just like, that's what makes it.
Yeah.
And it's so good. Yeah.
self-awareness that Annette Bening might not have had that is just like that little extra 2% that makes it funnier, smarter, you know, more the type of thing that elevates it beyond greatness into all-timer territory.
I totally agree. And I also wonder if, and I say this with all due respect to Annette Bening, but I do think that Michelle Pfeiffer is more of a movie star. I think she understands how to, the dials maybe a little bit. And I think about like, you know, Michelle Pfeiffer's been in Witches of Eastwick at this point, right? Like Michelle Pfeiffer's been in sort of wackadoo movies to some degree,
right,
that I think that she's probably like understands the movie she's in maybe a little better than Annette Bening would have. I also just think that Michelle just seemed from everything I read just to be so game. I mean, she you know, notoriously puts the bird in her mouth, which in hindsight she's like, I didn't think about what diseases I could get or anything. I
was just like, that's a great idea. Really,
is like behind the scenes footage of her actually cracking the whip and knocking the heads off the mannequins makes the rounds like every 2 weeks,
right,
of being like, did you know Michelle Pfeiffer actually did this? I did know that because I've seen this thing go around every single month 100%. Of the year. And it's worth it. Put it
I
out
also
there
feel
now.
Like she had to be vacuum sealed into the costume.
Yeah.
So it was so tight that they only had a short amount of time for her to perform. Otherwise she became lightheaded and would pass out. Like it was an undertaking that she was totally game for, but is insane.
I do want to see the scene where one of the stray cats has to zip her up in that thing or whatever. I do love her little, like,
her dismembered sock monkey has to, you know, get her in the suit.
This movie's dedication to having actual animals as sidekicks and, like, letting you imagine, like, how that would actually be a benefit in any way is really funny. Like, I really enjoy that.
I do love that the explanation for how Catwoman came to be was some cats licked her back to life.
Yeah, it's so tossed off. Fingers. It's so funny.
One of the things I remember as a child being absolutely
when she's rolling her eyes back,
the cat that's like chewing on her finger, but there's blood on her finger, but the cat doesn't appear to be drawing blood.
I remember that's one of those scenes I watched as a kid, as a young trans girl, and was like, I was like taking notes. I was like, is that how that works?
Is that
a thing? That's okay. So I die
need to find
some cats.
King of cats somewhere. Like, what's going on here? How does this go?
Of the animals, watching it this time, I really got a chuckle out of Penguin giving his enormously insane speech to a whole flock of penguins.
Yes.
As though they can understand what he's saying. One point where there's like a laugh line or an applause line and they start like cackling. And I'm like, what's going on here?
The best moment with the penguins is at the end when he's dead and they walk alongside him like pallbearers.
Pallbearer style.
Just like usher him into the deep. It's so funny. So silly.
I like watch this in 4K and you can really tell those penguins at the end are like fake. Like people in costumes. That made me like it even more. Like I think that is my favorite moment in the film is when they like take Penguin into the sea.
Well, Emily, I'll just say that we all deserve a penguin funeral.
We do. Can I share my hottest take ever?
Yes.
I don't get Michelle Pfeiffer at all. Like, ooh, I do what? Not. Like, spicy. As a as an actress, as a performer, I have loved her in certain roles. I think she's fantastic here. I'm not going to say she's not the best Catwoman because, like, I'm not going to sit here and stand for Anne Hathaway, though in my heart of hearts, I could. Like,
Anne Hathaway, by the way. Very good.
I love Anne Hathaway.
When I see this movie, I'm like, am I a straight woman? Because like Catwoman just kind of doesn't do anything for me. Like, and I love the performance. I think she's doing fantastic work. But it's like it is riding this fine. Here, this is also my problem with Death Becomes Her, which I guess we're going to get to.
And we have a hell of a guest for that one.
She is riding this fine line of camp and queer sensibility where you can tell she's done the reading and Tim Burton has no idea what's going on. And like tension is interesting and kind of drives the movie, but I think also kind of lets her down a little bit. I think she's really good in this movie. I don't get the like long lasting love for this performance though.
How long you got? No, it's fine. I have 13 pages of notes, so we'll get through all this. But no, I do think that I hear you. I mean, I don't agree with you, obviously, but I think that it's...
And I want to be clear, Death Becomes Her is a movie I actively don't like, so that's going to be fun.
It's going to be fun when we talk with... I'm not going to say who it is, but I'll tell you.
I know who it is. I know who it is.
All right. It's going to be great.
That person has won an Oscar, correct?
That person is an Academy Award winner.
If you guys got Goldie Hawn for that episode, I'm going to be so pissed.
We got Meryl. I do. So just to talk casting just very quickly about some of the roads not gone down when it came to the first choice that Tim Burton had for Penguin was Marlon Brando. The studio did
this is why you know that like this is an aesthetics decision. Like, yes, okay.
Yeah.
Tim got his book of fat people out, fat people in Hollywood, and he just started thumbing through. Yeah.
Incidentally, Marlon Brando, he might have been the winner for worst supporting actor at the Razzies that year for 1492. Conquest of America.
A movie we have covered on our podcast.
I gotta look this up because it was that category was so weird that year. And like,
I don't think he's in that Christopher Columbus movie. I think he's in the other Christopher Columbus movie. No.
He was nominated but lost to Tom Selleck in Christopher Columbus: The Discovery as King Ferdinand of Spain. Marlon Brando nominated as Tomas de Torquemada. Alan Alda in Whispers in the Dark, which I don't know. And then Danny DeVito and Robert Duvall in News Newsies, which
Robert Duvall playing Joseph Pulitzer in Newsies. Good golly.
I don't think he's bad in that movie. It's like a memorable performance. I just don't understand how you like remember that performance enough to be like, there's one of the worst performances of the year.
I mean, I don't. Yeah. I think that Marlon Brando was never going to do this movie. Like there was no world where he was going to do this movie that a studio was going to let him. I mean, like it's just, but the studio wanted Dustin Hoffman.
Because he's 5'6", you know?
I don't know. So they land obviously on DeVito. David Bowie was the first choice for Max Schreck.
That would have been good.
Yeah, it would have been good. He turned it down to do Twin Peaks Fire Walk With Me instead.
Oh, fucking perfect decision. Great decision.
So, I mean, there you go. Burgess Meredith was supposed to play the Penguin's father, but was too ill at the time and wasn't able to do it. So
that feels like typecasting.
Well, yeah.
Yeah.
I mean,
yeah.
The former Penguin.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
Yeah.
I was like, why does that feel like type? Oh, yeah. That makes
that
a
just
lot of
reminds
sense.
Me also of the fact that, like, when Burton started to do these movies, the only Batman I really knew, I didn't really watch the Adam West show, but I remember I watched the movie, the Batman movie with Adam West. And of course, that one, the villains are Joker, Penguin, Catwoman, and Riddler. And I thought those were the only four Batman villains. I never read comics. I didn't, you know. So I remember being like, well, if they're doing Penguin and Catwoman, I'm like, they're really kind of burning through all of them. And I remember when they announced Batman Forever and it was like Riddler and Tommy Lee Jones as Two-Face. I was like, I didn't think you could do that. Like, I just thought they had run out of villains with the Riddler. We're like, what's going on here? This is crazy.
I mean, DeVito's great. And he's the obvious choice. It is crazy to me that there was anyone else even in the conversation, quite honestly. Yeah. And maybe it's because they felt that DeVito wasn't a big enough movie star. I don't know. But he's perfect in this. We've covered the other 92 offerings that Danny DeVito gave us, which is a Hoffa, a movie.
Oh, right.
No good. Very bad. Don't watch it. But we covered it during the strike because it felt
he directed that one, right?
Yeah.
He directed and he's in it too.
Yeah.
He's one of those guys that, I mean, doesn't act a ton. He produces a lot, as we know. He's directed a handful of movies.
Jersey Films, Danny DeVito.
Jersey Films.
I always think of the way Julia Roberts says that. Jersey Films, Danny DeVito. Like,
when this movie came out and I was so hyped to see it, and then obviously I didn't. To me, Danny DeVito was the biggest star in the cast. I cannot explain to you why. I think I had just seen, like, I'd seen Twins and I'd seen Taxi.
Twins. We rented Twins a lot when we were kids. We watched that movie a lot.
I mean, that's 88. That's not that long before this. You know?
Yeah. Because for some reason.
And then I remember
reason,
we rented Throw Mama from the Train because it sounded silly. Funny. And we started to watch it and it was so much darker than we were prepared for. And like, I think
Anne Ramsey, Oscar nominee.
I think either at some point my mom was like, no, like watch something else. Like we're turning this off. Or we like lost interest. It was one of the two things where it's just like, it's not a fun movie for like kids to watch or whatever. It's just sort of like at some point it just gets to be, you know, a movie about adults who are not happy.
As a mom, Throw Mama from the Train is really just a kind of movie I don't want in my house. Out of my house.
I mean, it is interesting because like he starts to get into direct. I mean, Throw Mama from the Train is his directorial debut. That's in 87. Mm-hmm. In 89, he does War of the Roses, which I love. We did a contentious episode of 1989 on that one. I wrote for it quite hard and it didn't go over well, but I think it's a great movie. I think it's a very funny movie. Yeah. He does this in Hoffa 92. Then he's like Jack the Bear, a movie I've never seen. I don't know. Maybe that movie's good.
I've seen that movie. Gary Sinise he's raising two children and they're a Jewish family. Reese Witherspoon is in it as like the older son's like crush, basically. Gary Sinise plays a Nazi in the neighborhood who then terrorizes the family. Very strange movie. Very strange movie.
Sounds strange. Renaissance Man, notoriously Penny Marshall deciding to do that instead of Forrest Gump.
Yeah.
A choice that I imagine she probably wouldn't make again, or wouldn't have made again. Junior, everyone's favorite movie about Arnold Schwarzenegger being pregnant.
Another film I was forbidden from seeing. They thought I would watch that movie and get some ideas about gender. And I didn't. So I was not allowed to come out until my 30s because I didn't see Junior in 1994.
Have you seen Junior? Just fall. Yeah.
I haven't. If I saw it, I would become even more trans.
Junior is truly crazy. You guys have seen Junior, Chris and Joe? Have you
guys seen Junior?
Junior's
one of those movies that's just like terrifying.
It is a wonder that the gender binary continues to exist because Junior existed and tore it down.
I saw Junior in the theater. I saw Junior in the theater. My parents took me to see it.
Oh, wow.
Don't know why. Two things have literally like are burned in my brain. The first is this sort of fever dream that Arnold Schwarzenegger has of a baby with his face that they superimposed onto the baby's face,
yep.
which is just like a fucking nightmare fuel. Yep. And then the end, when he punches a man and says, "My body, my choice."
I am so furious that Junior received a single Academy Award nomination because I would love to come on the program and
Come on the Patreon. We'll talk about Junior.
We'll discuss gender. Yeah.
We'll do like, you know, obviously Danny DeVito's got some great stuff in the 90s. He, you know, Get Shorty, he's great in. LA Confidential, he's great in. The Rainmaker, he's actually really good in.
He's an underrated movie. Rainmaker. I love him in that
So
movie.
Like, he's just, when he shows up, he's can be really great. And then he's done like, what, 8 million episodes of It's Always Sunny in Philadelphia.
Right. Yeah. You know? Yeah.
But it is just kind of fascinating that he's kind of on the fence about doing this movie. Probably just because of, I imagine, what he expected would be a pretty arduous undertaking. And he wasn't wrong, but he's great in this movie. And then I just to quickly just talk Keaton for a second, a guy who, you know, obviously didn't want to do this movie. But at this point in his career, he does Batman, Pacific Heights, thriller where he's trying to break into a young couple's house, right?
Melanie Griffith.
San Francisco.
Is it Melanie Griffith?
I think it is Melanie Griffith.
And Matthew Modine. Yes.
There you go.
Logical thriller. One Good Cop, a movie I've never seen or heard
of. That's a misleading title.
Actually, it's not. There's only one. So okay. It works out.
This is about the single good cop.
One good cop. Yeah. And it's the lady from Onward or whatever the hell. It's the
it's one of the dogs from Paw Patrol.
The lesbian cop from Onward. It's Chase from Paw Patrol. That's true. That's my nephew's favorite Paw Patrol. So yeah, we'll let him.
So he does this movie. He gets paid $11 million to do it. Then he does Much Ado About Nothing. He's in that with like everyone and their mother. Just the hottest cast that's ever been.
One of the hottest movies ever made.
He is chewing some scenery in that movie too. Like he is just having a ball.
It seems like he's gunning for an Oscar with My Life. Remember My Life?
I do remember My Life. Even that trailer was just like, we're going to make you cry. Like that thing was just really.
He's dying and he's making a video for his kid. Yep. I love him in The Paper. Paper under. Great movie. You know, Speechless, Multiplicity. He comes back, does Jackie Brown and Out of Sight. You know, I mean, like Michael Keaton's great. Gets kind of, obviously he's been just sort of, he was given a big kind of. Newfound life to his career, Birdman, Spotlight, you know, Spider-Man, what have you. He's chewing the scenery in Dumbo with a hairpiece that's from the heavens. I don't know what that hairpiece is, but it's crazy.
I'm still mad they decided to put everybody from Spotlight into supporting that year because he absolutely could and should have gotten a Best Actor nomination for that movie.
Mm-hmm. I totally agree. And I also think he should have won over fucking...
Chris can complain about Eddie Redmayne together.
Yeah,
Chris,
fuck
it. I know.
Chris is an enemy.
I hate Birdman with a passion.
I don't like
absolutely.
Birdman.
He should have won over Eddie Redmayne. That Eddie Redmayne performance is so bad.
It's also
the only
just
person
like
who liked that performance.
that kind of, I know it's slightly different, but I'm gonna just compare it anyway. The Keaton and Eddie Redmayne felt very much like the Sean Penn Mickey Rourke situation.
I was going to say yes.
Where everyone was just sort of like, you should give it to Mickey Rourke. He's better in this movie, and like, he's back, and it's great that he's back. And they should have given it to Keaton as well. Like, it's just Eddie Redmayne's performance is just ridiculous.
Listen, there's still time to get it for. Wait, did Knox Goes Away get an actual release this year? Is it was just a festival?
No, it's coming out next year from I don't even think. Like, is it another Vertical Catch Up Studios movie or whatever the hell it is? It's like sub. Vertical
what is Knox Goes Away? What is this movie? It's, I'm looking at it right now.
He directed. Debut? Yeah. Yes. No, it's not a debut. It's He's directed other movies.
Okay.
Or at least one other movie. It got absolutely no reception at TIFF this year.
It got 48% on Rotten Tomatoes from 27 critics.
So, Phil, do you even need to ask? Remember Knox? This is the movie where he's going away.
He's going away.
Yeah, he went away.
It's the final. Yeah. It's the final Knox movie of the Knox series. Yeah,
the Knox cycle.
Knox
is it? Is it
camp.
Part of the like Ben comes back?
Yeah.
Series?
Yes.
Yeah.
It's
Ben is back. Knox is away.
No. Yeah. It's Knox goes to camp. Knox saves Christmas. Knox scared stupid. Knox goes to jail. Yeah.
Knox 2 back in the habit.
Yeah. Oh God, would watch. By the way,
I just reminded myself who was nominated for Best Actor that year, and like Keaton is my pick out of all the nominees. That was such a bad year. Like the only other one I really think about is like I could have gone with Bradley Cooper in another movie I don't like very much, but I think he's good in American Sniper.
Oh, it's him. It's right. Carell for Foxcatcher, and then who's the fifth?
It's Benedict Cumberbatch for Imitation Game.
Imitation Game.
That year sucks, man. I mean, that year's also like I hate that that Birdman versus Boyhood became the narrative. Because first of all, I think Boyhood is an infinitely better movie than Birdman is. But then like also mixed into that, you've got Grand Budapest that kind of gets.
I was gonna say Grand Budapest gets 8 bajillion nominations and none for Ralph Fiennes, who was better than anybody who was actually nominated for Best Actor that year.
Bonkers. Like, bonkers.
The fuck?
It's crazy. So to kind of just jump through this plot of Batman Returns, a movie that we all kind of know, there's some stuff, obviously, that, you know, watching it this time jumped out at me. I love the Paul Rubens cameo up top. I love that the baby's bassinet that you were talking about, Chris, is like literally sealed shut with a giant fucking belt.
Yeah. Yeah.
Like, this penguin baby is not getting out of this fucking bassinet.
Also, I'm wondering, like, Diane Salinger plays his mother, Diane Salinger from Pee-wee's Big Adventure. And I, of course, remember her from HBO's Carnival, where she played Clea DuVall's fortune-telling catatonic mother.
Underrated show. Great show.
One would imagine she would have had some explaining to do when all of a sudden the baby comes and the baby is a penguin baby. And... I'm not going to judge anybody for anything ever, but like,
listen, how do you think that zoo got shut down?
That was the scandal that the mayor barely survived. Ugh. No wonder he was so vulnerable for, come re-election all those years later. Yeah.
Ugh. I mean, this movie really also just, you know, not to go down too much of a rabbit hole on the production of it, but like a staggeringly beautifully made movie. There are no exteriors. This entire film is shot on sound stages, which is something that we don't do anymore. It's probably why the movie feels a little bit hermetically sealed and a little bit small and kind of snow globey, but that's sort of the point.
The town square set in Gotham outside of Shrek's, where they're doing all of these outdoor press conferences for a group of tens of people.
Mm-hmm.
It feels so they're doing what they can on the soundstage and it's all beautiful, but when you look at it in that scale, it feels very small.
This being a Christmas movie, though, there is some degree to which I'm like, maybe I can get down with the idea of Gotham as like a small town in like a Gremlins kind of a way, where like, you know what I mean? Where it's just like there's the town square and maybe sometimes it's easy for a crackpot like Oswald Cobblepot to get elected mayor in a small town like that.
Yeah,
like, although God, it's a weird thing watching that whole storyline in a post-Trump
that's
mindset. It's, how could they possibly have run a genuine monster half penguin man and win election?
a horny groping.
Yeah.
Constantly drooling.
Trump could bite off a reporter's nose in the middle of Times Square and they'd still vote for him. Like,
If Trump came out tomorrow and ate a raw fish on stage, I wouldn't vote for him, but I would be like, I'm giving you a point, sir. Good for you.
You get 1 point.
Emily point. Yeah.
I do think,
Trump
though, it is
interesting. Trump does not have the fashion sense of Penguin's giant winter coat, though. That coat is fabulous.
The top hat, the giant.
The top hat. Bring them back, guys.
Bring the top hat back.
What's stopping you from looking like this? And it's just a picture of Penguin with the top hat. Like, that's what I'm asking.
But I do think it's interesting to see the progression away from these sound stages. Now, I know that obviously Chris Nolan is Chris Nolan, and he's always going to go location. He's scope and David Lean and all that kind of stuff. And I've absolutely no problem with that. It's one of the things that I love about his versions of them. But I do think that one of the reasons that I love this film is because it feels like a movie in a different way. It just, you know what I mean? You can see the German expressionism. You can see all the builds, all the Selena's apartment with these like fucking ridge beams going through her kitchen and like this kind of like rusted, dilapidated kind of weird post-industrial thing that's going on.
That was one of the things I did like about the 2022 film is it is a lot of it's digitally enhanced, but you did kind of get back to that feel after the, you know, where Snyder's films are very obviously mostly digital sets and then Nolan is really trying to use real locations. That had that feeling of like, I like my comic book movies to feel like they're like in a comic book. Obviously, I famously love Dick Tracy, which is like my Batman Returns.
It's the best.
But yeah, like I honestly don't mind that this movie feels a little small. It does feel a little bit like it takes place in like one of those Christmas villages that you can buy at like a fucking Michael's or something.
Yep.
So yeah.
Yeah, I think it's a choice. The first movie, you know, shot in London. Warner Brothers notoriously spent a boatload of money to hold onto those sets, and then Burton's like, actually, I want to shoot it in Burbank. And they were like, cool, thanks for, you know, again, this was a movie that because they had a lot of live penguins, they had to freeze these sets. So these sets were very, very cold. They were deeply refrigerated in order to, you know, so it's just a ridiculous thing that he put Warner Brothers through in terms of, you know, there's a lot of fake snow, but there's a lot of, you know, it's a pretty meticulously, strangely orchestrated thing. I respect it.
Yeah, I was going to say, like, more power to him, man. Like, do your thing. Yeah. He just made, like, you know, the sad song of Warner Brothers. Like, they just made so much money off of that first Batman. Like, you know what I mean? Like, he made them so much money. He basically owned that entire year.
Totally.
The merchandising angle, especially of the first Batman and the cultural impact that had, really cannot be underestimated. And especially for the appeal towards kids and the tenor of reactions to this movie. That was one thing that I was struck on this rewatch is, you know, as annoying all of those talk show kids who go on rallying against how this movie hate kids. Unfortunately, those losers may have a point. because I almost feel like one of the most obvious things that Tim Burton is in a fuck you phase of his career is setting this movie at Christmas, because you show up for a summer Batman movie and immediately it announces itself with snow, which feels like this immediate fuck you to the audience and this denial of what they are expecting from it.
Right.
Selina Kyle is not just destroying like this pink feminine view of her apartment, but like she's not destroying Barbies. She's destroying stuffed animals. She's breaking toys. She's breaking a dollhouse in this movie.
Yeah.
It feels, you know, like Tim Burton hating the toyification of Batman and his movies, you know.
I mean,
sequence in this movie has like 16 different toys that you can like imagine purchasing at a Kmart.
Those toys. I had the Batman Super Nintendo video game that's basically just, you know.
Yeah, but even just the opening literally you are attacked by a giant present. Inside a present, yes,
that's right,
is a gang of thugs that
circus escape. Yeah.
I mean, truly, this movie is just thumbing its nose at you and just being like, you know.
I think I have the solution to this, is this movie and Home Alone 2 should have swapped release dates. And they should have, our Home Alone 2 episode is not yet released.
Coming out next
week.
But
in that episode, I proposed that Home Alone 2 should have been set at summer camp or on summer vacation instead of being a Christmas film. And so you put that out in June. Macaulay Culkin would have had to work his ass off to make that release date, but I feel like he could have done it.
Macaulay, though, not Chris Columbus.
Chris Columbus, he's fine. Whatever.
I've always said that Home Alone 2 should have been a Thanksgiving movie because the whole thing about New York City is that, like, there's a giant fucking parade on Thanksgiving that, like, you could have had, like, but summer's good too.
I think it should be also a Friday the 13th movie. So it's like Kevin versus Jason.
Kevin puts on a hockey mask and starts killing a bunch of people.
Right.
This whole opening portion where, like, Selena gets sort of held hostage for a brief moment by a clown.
Right.
I love the moment with the taser where you see that little twistedness inside her, which obviously, you know, comes out more as the movie progresses. The penguins also kind of slow played in terms of, like, we see his hands on the bars, we see his shadows in the suit. Like, we're really kind of building up to this reveal of this disgusting creature. Like, on some level, had they also not built it up so much? Like, the first 10 minutes of this movie is all build up to his reveal.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And then the reveal is him going like, hi. It's so strange.
And with, like, this guy has a really well-developed sense of how to appeal to people with hokum, like the whole, like, he's really kind of honed almost like a passive aggressive, like, I guess I'll look for my parents, I don't know why they would have just thrown me away like this, like,
it's very Eeyore like it's got very a very Eeyore-like. Kind of which is great. I love the scene with Selena going back. She walks into her apartment, she does the whole, like, honey, I'm home, oh, I forgot I'm not married, and then she does it like a zombie later when she comes back after she's been killed. But the scene at the office with this gothic lighting from below with all these lamps and her glasses looking like the cat mask that's coming with the shadows is just tremendous. It's just really, there's actually, and I didn't notice it until the millionth rewatch, but on her lamp is a post-it note that just says obey in big block letters.
Oh, I didn't notice that. That's amazing.
So, like, there's just a lot of stuff baked into a very small scene between her and Chris Walken before he kills her.
A scene which starts where she's already come across this, like, incriminating information. Like, that's what I love about this movie, is just, like, we don't really need to spend, like, any other movie would have, like, shown the scene where she's, like, going through the files and gets wide-eyed at this, like, plot or whatever. It's just, like, I'm like, just, like, fast forward past that part or whatever, like, shove her out the window, and then, like, what we'll spend time on is the makeover montage that, like, we will, like, that one's gonna hit. I love any movie where a superhero or a supervillain, in this case, you see them go through the actual, like, process of designing their look, where she's, you know, finding the leather coat,
her raincoat, her leather raincoat.
I
mean, there's a creepy moment before he pushes her out the window where he, like, looks like he's gonna kiss her, like he leans in for a kiss and then goes and then he pushes her out. It's a very weird beat.
He's so good, like, he's great. What a fucking creep. It's great.
Emily, do you have Chris Walken feelings?
Chris Walken feelings? I like it's this thing where I like him in the movie and I like Max Schreck as a character, and yet I kind of feel like his dramatic function just isn't, like, he's in a different movie and I'm not sure that, you know, that entirely works. But, like, I love Chris Walken so much. Kind of like.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot. We charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.
The performance of his that this seems most similar to me is the Weapon of Choice music video, and I can't explain why. It just feels like Max Schreck might start flying around and dancing. So
it feels like the cliche Christopher Walken performance, or like what we would think of a Christopher Walken performance would be like in the aughts, happened all the way back in 1992, and then, you know, took a while to cook or something to become, you know, the quintessential Chris Walken.
I totally agree, and it also feels very Burton looking for his Vincent Price-esque, or Martin Landau, looking for his older sort of experienced elder statesman that slots into his weird little world. And obviously, you know, Chris Walken comes back again, has no lines as the Headless Horseman, but does come back as him, with Burton later. The whole idea of Catwoman's costume falling apart as her sanity starts to slip as well is something that I love. The her claws, which are
leaving
sort
a trail of claws across all
the,
across
the thimbles from like that are a constant reminder of that this is all kind of sewn together and it's all dangling by a thread.
Well, even the costume, great. It's like you see just like the slashes of staples, like sort of like going over. It's like this is not sleek. This is very DIY.
Yeah,
absolutely. I'm a fan of a microfiche scene. Always love someone.
Yes, absolutely,
always is good. Yep. Like it's never bad. Alfred saying, this is one of my favorite lines in the movie, "Must you be the only lonely man beast in town?"
Alfred was getting lippy in this one, and I was really enjoying it.
Alfred's so good in this movie.
So good. It's just, it's tremendous. You know, it is interesting too that, like, you mentioned, Emily, and I agree with you, that Burton has base interest in the action scenes. You can tell that he's literally shooting an action sequence with like six different cameras, because you'll see things fall like six different times because he only wants to do it once and he doesn't want to have to really do much coverage. He's just not interested in this stuff. That being said, the first Catwoman fight where she stops that mugger with that girl is great, because it's short, it's sweet, and you can tell that he's actually like interested in seeing Catwoman fight.
Yes.
I just don't know that he's interested in seeing Batman fight, if that makes sense.
It's a ranked list of like most interested Catwoman, then Batman, then like not at all in Penguin at all. Like Penguin doesn't even like get to even pretend to fight. It's just like he'll open an umbrella every once in a while and like that's about it.
I feel like Penguin should like get to slide around and knock people over like a real Penguin does. Yeah. That should be a thing he gets to do.
He should have gotten a vehicle.
But he does, because Burton loves the giant duck.
The giant rubber ducky.
Oh, right. He does have that vehicle. Yeah.
He does have the giant duck, which he off-roads.
Mostly an elevator.
I prefer this film to the 89 Batman substantially, but one area in which it falls down is it doesn't have a Prince song about the Penguin, which
is true. That, you know, it's funny you bring that up Emily, because this time I did feel it a little bit, because I love the Susie and the Banshee song that they get that plays during the Masquerade Ball, which is a great song. And I watched the music video for the first time, which is so beautifully early 90s. God bless it. Nice. But I do agree with you, Emily, that like it's clear that Burton didn't want Prince necessarily. Like, I don't think he wanted that punctuation, but it really does pull you through that movie. Like, the Prince song's really do help that movie.
Well, yeah. If Bowie wasn't going to play Max Schreck, he should have done some songs. I totally agree with you. I don't know if Prince is the right vibe for this movie. I totally think Bowie could have been like, Bowie, and then the penguin came to town and he had a little cape.
I'm absolutely all for your Bowie impression singing about the little penguin boy.
Oh, listen, when we get to Twin Peaks, I'm giving you my David Lynch. That's my best.
Cannot wait. You guys mentioned the scene when Max lures the penguin downstairs with a raw fish to his to his mayoral
to his campaign team. Yeah.
And then we obviously have the it could be worse. My nose could be gushing blood. And then he bites a man's nose and has blood all over him. And he's eating a raw fish.
Also a moment that terrified me as a child.
Yeah, same. Yeah.
And he desperately wants to have sex with Jen Hooks.
Who among us? Yeah.
It's all a lot. And then this scene ends with Max saying he will have unlimited poontang.
I wrote that down. I was like, wow, I've seen a movie where Chris Walken says unlimited poontang. So at the very least, that happens.
It's bonkers. It's
you
bonkers.
Know, do you remember when like desktop computers would let you like put your own like sound? Like you'd make a certain thing your when it starts up or like you click a button something. Sure. Yep. I unlimited poontang feels like it was made for that. Yep. Like it was made for like you open a file and Chris Walken says unlimited poontang.
It's the Batman answer to Electric Boogaloo. It should have been Batman 2 unlimited poontang.
That does also answer the question of whether I did ever see this in the theater, which is going to be no, because if my mom ever took us to see Batman Returns. If unlimited poontang didn't send her dragging us out of the theater, Danny DeVito saying just the pussy I'm looking for would have absolutely sealed the deal. He would have never made it to the end of that movie.
She says something like, I can't remember where the line is, but he's like scented or unscented. Like he's got like lubrication.
I can't remember now.
The line now. But that whole scene.
She means ointment for her napalm arm. Yes. Yeah.
Ointment, scented or unscented. it's a lot. We then have sort of the Bruce and Selena dating stuff, which I really love. That scene in front of the fire, you know, where she has the whole, it's the so-called normal guys that always let you down. Sickos don't scare me. At least they're committed. Mm-hmm. And that they have just a really great banter. And again, this comes back to sort of, the Selena Bruce stuff feels very noirish to me. Like that's when it feels like the movie is really leaning into that old sort of like 30s. And very much so in arguably one of my favorite scenes of the movie, which is the reveal on the dance floor has such a noir kind of moment of realization and the strings. And like, there's just, and even their confrontation or what have you at the end where he's kind of begging her to run away with him. Mm-hmm. Like all that stuff feels very much like lifted out of a 30s movie. It's great stuff.
As we talk about this, I think my issue is I like the Batman and Penguin movie. I like the Batman and Catwoman movie. I'm not sure they're the same movie, you know? Like then there's Max Schreck and you're like, okay. And he's supposed to be what ties it all together, but he does so through a very, and like, I love the script for this movie on the level of like it has a lot of provocative ideas and like it's very interested in pushing the envelope of what a blockbuster should be, but just like it is trying to do so many things and Tim Burton is very clearly interested in some things more than others.
And 100%. I agree with that while at the same time thinking the scene where Penguin and Catwoman first really meet up and the scene where he just says the scented or unscented and where she eats the bird and then she starts
cleaning herself
is maybe my favorite scene in the whole movie. I love a villains get together because they have a common enemy and we have to like, you know, figure it out. But also forming. Just like the way that the way they play off of each other and the way that she's clearly like, you know, stringing him along while also being like slightly oblivious to just how gross he is because like she's more concerned with setting up her own operation and how they can get Batman and whatever. And that's the point in the movie where I'm just like, I can just watch these two. I could just watch the Penguin and Catwoman hour. Sure, of,
but
you know.
That scene, I love that scene so much because it feels like it harkens back to the 60s Batman movie. Yes. Where it's like half of that thing is just the villains sitting in a room talking about how much they hate Batman. Like,
totally.
Yes, that whole movie of that.
I also, to your point, to both of your points, the scene where after the Ice Princess dies and it's all pinned on Batman and they're standing up sort of up on the roof or whatever, and he's saying, you know, you come into my room twitching your little tail, and he's got a ring for her and it's like ready to consummate their relationship, and she's like, I wouldn't touch you to scratch you, and he's like, you let me on, and the look on
your face
is amazing.
Lousy minx, I should have had your spade. Yeah,
you sent out all the signals.
Yeah, you sent out all the signals.
And she, the look on her face is so great because it's so classically like a woman being like, "What the fuck are you talking about?" Like,
right.
Like, what? It's such a great. And then, of course, he kills her. Yes.
The 25th anniversary of this film was 2017. I am genuinely surprised there weren't 10 dozen think pieces about the ways in which Catwoman and Penguin's relationship resembles white women's relationship to Trump. Like, I should have written that. I would have gotten so many clicks. Like, so many people would have been like, click, 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 click. I would have won. I never would have gotten fired.
That would have done it.
Yeah. That would have done it. I mean, I do think that the mistletoe thing is a wonderful sort of conjoiner. In terms of it's a great line, and it's a great line to then be the reveal later in the film. The whole, like, mistletoe can be deadly if you eat it, but a kiss can be deadlier if you mean it, is just, I don't know. All that stuff, to your point, Emily, I think that stuff works really well. It all kind of feels slightly disjointed. I don't think that it's as disjointed for me as it is for you, but I can see how it feels like different camps of movies.
I think if I liked Burton, I think if I liked him more, and like, to be clear, I like some of his stuff a fair bit. Sure. I think if I liked him more, if I was on his wavelength, this movie would be like I fucking love looking at this movie.
Sure.
In terms of like Christmas vibe, I think it, you know, which is the thing I care about deeply. I think it's one of the best. But like, here, for instance, I don't really like Nightmare Before Christmas either. And like, that feels like a movie I should love.
I like it less than it seems like I should. Like, every year, not every year, but every time I watch it, I'm like, this is the point where I'm going to become a Nightmare Before Christmas person, because I feel like I want to be. And it just doesn't. And then I like, fine, I'll just go watch the Family Stone again. Like, that's fine. Yeah.
Yeah. It's good. It's a good movie that suggests a great one. And I wish that I saw the great one that a lot of people get from. I think this is just like, I'm just not a person who read comic books growing up. And I'm like,
I didn't either.
And like, that's like, not, I'm not saying that's the reason I don't like these, but it is like a thing where I think there are some people who take from a certain level of visual iconography and like extrapolate that out into like imagining an entire world. And like, for them, Burton is perfect. And I'm not that person. I rarely am.
I absolutely hear you. I really do. And every time I watch this film, I think to myself, it's a miracle that this got made, because I can't imagine there's that many people that this appeals to. Now, listen, there's three and a half people on this. And by that, I mean, Emily, you seem halfway into liking this movie. But I just, you know what I mean? Like, it is.
Oh, I'm giving it an 85. You're going to be shocked.
I can't wait. There are two lines at the Masquerade Ball that I love. Max saying, I am the light of the city and I am its mean twisted soul is just insane. And then Bruce saying, so no hard feelings, and Selena saying, semi-hard, I'd say.
Yeah.
Can I also mention a thing I noticed for the first time in that Masquerade Ball scene is when, I think it's when Selena is entering the ballroom, she's just coming down the stairs, right? There is somebody dressed up like what the Phantom of the Opera is dressed as in the masquerade number in Phantom of the Opera. And it's for like half a second, I'm like, wait a second, is Tim Burton this time around going to do a full masquerade Andrew Lloyd Webber production number before we get on with the rest of this movie? I would have welcomed it.
It's, I just, for a second, this scene of the reveal, we have seen at this point in cinema so many identity reveals in mm-hmm. comic book movies, like innumerable. And this still is my favorite because it feels like it has actual character power to it, as opposed mm-hmm. to just sort of the surprise of a person surprised that a person is a fucking superhero. Mm-hmm. This is two people that perhaps might have feelings for each other outside of their extracurricular activities. They're both selling it so hard mm-hmm. that it really works for me.
Definitely. I think for me, I think that's when Kirsten Dunst figures out Tobey Maguire's Spider-Man in
Spider-Man the end 2. Of the first Spider-Man. Mm-hmm.
I think, is that the end of the first, or like,
well, this is the question that I've often wondered, which is she kisses him at the end and we're left with a look on her face like she's put it together, but then she hasn't put it together.
It's incontrovertible in 2. I feel like in 1, it's mm-hmm. like that thing where you're like, I know something about my partner, but I'm not going to like think too hard about it. And like, I think the reason I love those movies is that relationship. And like, so yeah, for me, I don't know. I think, but yeah, it is very weird how many of these movies we've seen and how rarely like the reveal affects anything outside of the world knowing who they are. And they're all chasing Tony Stark saying, yeah, I'm Iron Man at the end of Iron Man, which is a great moment, but like, yeah.
Yeah.
Can't do that again.
I mean, that scene that's is Marvel's also thing though. I mean, is to be sort of on Front Street about it, but yeah.
That scene is also not entirely dissimilar to the 30 Rock, where Liz goes on the date with the guy and then finds out that they're third cousins or whatever. And the realization sort of dawns on the both of them at the exact same time. She sees the photo of her great aunt and he's like, no, that's my grandmother. And I'm like, oh, okay. Yeah.
Yes, sure. I agree with that. Max in a giant birdcage over a pool of toxic waste is just a great image. That I love.
That's a deeply Tim Burton image too.
I texted this to you, Emily, when I was rewatching it, and I stand by it being an absurd line in Penguin's speech to his army of penguins. Mm-hmm. Thanks to Batman, the time has come to punish all God's children, first, second, third, and fourth born. Why be biased? Male and female, hell, the sexes are equal when their erogenous zones are blown sky high.
You sent that to me and I saw the preview on my Apple Watch. I was like, what the fuck is Phil doing? I was making my baby dinner. I was like, what?
What's going on? Well, yeah, sans context, my apologies, Emily. No, I didn't mean fine. To.
That's then my baby was like, well, it's. He's quoting Batman
One
Returns.
More
Come
for
on.
The HR yeah. file, and there we go.
It's just, it is such a bizarre speech. As I mentioned earlier, to hundreds of penguins that don't know what the fuck he's talking about. And it's just, there's something so, because like, there are many, many evil villain speeches in the annals of comic book movies that all feel kind of, you know, preachy and whatever. This is just like, what's his goal? Just literally just death and destruction at this point. Like, it just doesn't care.
I'm imagining the person mm-hmm. who saw this movie and saw that speech and was like, how do I get to do that? Like, dedicates themselves to marine biology, goes to school, like goes through the years and years, gets a job at an aquarium, works their way up the ladder of that aquarium, become the chief penguin caretaker. First day, they deliver that speech, and they're like, I think that was worth it.
Totally worth it. It starts with getting one penguin to listen to you, and then it's just like you build from there. You just start small, and
to get the penguins to unionize so that they can tell their other penguin friends, to show up to the speech.
I'm also just imagining, you know, I being on the Warner Brothers lot in a refrigerated set when like 400 penguins are just let loose with little metal helmets and missiles on their back. And you're just like, action. Like, it's just absurd, but it's fantastic. I'm all about it.
I think I almost love imagining Warner Brothers executives watching the dailies from this film more than I love watching it itself. Like, yeah.
They clearly made so much money off of the first movie that all those executives watching those dailies just didn't care. They were just like, you can do whatever. You are a printing press to us.
Yeah. We got toys. We got Happy Meals. Yeah. We're good.
Yeah.
And then, you know, it all went very, very different. I do love the fight with Penguin and Batman when he says, you're just jealous. I'm a genuine freak and you have to wear a mask. And Batman says, you might be right. Like, there's just something so...
Batman's so disengaged that entire fight. Like, he barely, the thing where he, like, grabs the detonator out of his hand or whatever, and it's just like, and then, like, just sort of stands around with it for a little bit, and it's just like, Batman, let's just, like, do something. Jesus Christ.
He's very inactive in this movie.
Very inactive.
And it's only when he's forced to be active that he's active.
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, I do love, as I mentioned earlier, the sort of final conversation between Bruce and Selina, and him being like, don't you see we're the same, you know, and she says, I wish I could run away with you and live in your castle forever, but I just couldn't live with myself, so don't pretend this is a happy ending. Like, this movie just dangles the possibility of a happy ending in front of you and then says, nah.
Sticks to her principles. Like, it's when she saves the woman earlier in the movie, and she's just like, you know, essentially like, stop making yourself such an easy victim or whatever. It's just like, she has a very specific code of ethics all of a sudden that the cats gave her when they resurrected her. And now she's sticking to it.
Yeah. I mean, I also kind of love that we have sort of this moment with her and Max where he shoots her, like, I guess we're led to believe it's a six shooter, so he's got five bullets left, and he shoots her five times.
Classic movie logic. All guns only have six bullets. Like, that's
right. She's only got, she basically is like, I have two lives left. I think I'll save one for next Christmas. How about a kiss, Santa Claus?
With the
taser. It's interesting that the original cut of this movie, she's dead. She's gone.
Yeah.
They think she, you know, whatever. They spend $250,000
for that last shot.
Make that last shot of her pop up at the very end, because at test screenings, they were like, we want more Catwoman.
Just cut out something out of black construction paper and just sort of like push it in front of the camera.
Worth every damn penny, though.
It is worth it entirely.
One of the most iconic endings.
Yeah. It's incredible. It's not Michelle Pfeiffer. It's just some person that they just decided to pop up.
Sean Young was still on the lot. And they let her stand there.
But it is just interesting how, like, you know, they have the one life left. I think you were still going to see the shadow in the alleyway. So, like, I think there's still kind of an ellipse there of, like, she's still alive or whatever, but they wanted that last shot and they got it. But
it allows the last spoken line in the movie to be one of the most insane things I've ever heard, which is Bruce Wayne going, peace on earth and goodwill toward men, looks at a thing, thinks about it for a second, and women. Like,
looks at a black cat in his arm.
Right, it was the black cat, that's right. And then, like, it's just like, are you waiting for applause? Like, what's going on? Like, Bruce, like, Jesus Christ, man. Like,
yeah,
and women.
Batman's so fucking woke in this movie, and he needs to be taken down a peg.
What's with this woke Batman?
Woke mind Batman.
Listen, let's rate this movie.
All right,
I will go first. In 92, I probably would have given this film like a 72. I liked it fine. I didn't really jive with it. I then watched it 8 million times over the course of the, you know, years that have gone since. I'm giving this film a 97. I very few notes about this movie. I love this movie, warts and all. It is imperfect, but it is perfect to me. So that's where I am at. Chris, where are you?
I am willing to chalk up this movie's flaws to Batman Returns just being a vibes movie, and I'm going to give it a 90.
Great. Sounds great. What about you, Joe?
Yeah, I think I'm on a similar wavelength. I think even the, and again, we've pointed out quite a few things about this movie that are odd or strange or low energy in terms of Michael Keaton, and yet almost all of it I think works for me. I don't even feel like I'm looking past it. I feel like a lot of the stuff that's weird about this movie just ends up working for me. Like DeVito and the Penguin so much more than I even thought I did before I watched it again this time. Sure. So I think I'm up to like a 92.
Great. Here it is, Emily. It's your moment of truth.
I was just thought of a thing I love, which is the first time you see Michael Keaton. He's just staring like this.
He's just sitting in the dark. Side. Wait, sitting have dark, none of us mentioned him scratching the CD of
which is not a thing.
You know, which is not a thing you can do. Yeah,
that is the Christmas vibe of this movie. Is him sitting alone in a dark room, and then a bright light goes up outside, and he's like, "Oh, like that."
And then it's literally to your point, Emily, sitting like this, pensive in a dark room by himself.
Like,
and then the Batman logo comes in. And
also,
I wonder if he'll call, but he is Commissioner Gordon. Like, yeah.
And like Michael Keaton's actual Christmas movie, Jack Frost, doesn't have anything brilliantly Christmassy. I actually think I have a very different journey with this film, which is I pretty much have, like, the first time I saw it on broadcast television in 1995, I was like, I think that's actually really interesting and doing cool things, and it's good.
Sure.
Like, my teenage self was, like, locked into it. And then I just, like, never evolved past that point. I just have been like, yeah, I think this is a really interesting movie that's doing some good things. So I came in at an 85. And for you, Phil, I'm going to go all the way up to an 86. I realized that Batman had the woke mind virus, and now I'm giving it a zero. So.
Zero.
No. The queerphobia scale.
Yeah, yeah. Where's this fall
on that? It's really fucking hard to say. Because this movie, like, has shifted. Like, this is one of those movies. It's kind of like Basic Instinct, where at the time, I think people were like, this is kind of gay. Isn't that funny? And now we're like, this is kind of gay. That fucking rules.
That rules.
So, like, yeah, I'm going to give it like a four. I think that, like, out of 10. And I think that, like, there is some stuff in here that does feel like it's a little bit mean to the queers, but also, like, it feels like Tim Burton doesn't quite know that. And, like, obviously the script is like, so it's like 16 different, but yeah, there is a little bit of this movie where you're kind of like, is this making fun of me? But I don't think it is.
The one most explicitly queer coded character does get his nose bitten off, so that
is true.
I
would also be remiss if I didn't talk about the premiere of this movie for a quick second, because I've seen the stills of the red carpet for this film and the sort of the big premiere that they had with this giant, like, weird thing. I think it was Grauman's, if I'm not mistaken. Maybe it was in Westwood, one or the other. At that point, Michael Keaton is dating Courtney Cox, so she to the premiere of Batman Returns. Michelle Pfeiffer is dating Fisher Stevens with a neck beard that is just completely insane.
Wow.
And I'm just like, how did Fisher Stevens,
Fisher Stevens has gumped his way through Hollywood all of these decades. It's really something else. It's Oscar crazy. Winner, integral part of the final season of Succession. Like, all of these, like, every once in a while, it's just like, it's Fisher Stevens, it's time to shine. Yeah.
I recently, like, did a book on Lost, and you watch that show and you forget Fisher Stevens has this, like, tiny pivotal part in season 4, and, like, one of the great TV episodes of all time. You're like, yep, there's Fisher Stevens.
There he is. He's always been there.
I feel who was Pat Hingle's date to the premiere?
That's a very good question. I'm not sure. I didn't see that. But I mean, the Fisher Stevens thing is fascinating. And just did that docuseries on Beckham. He just directed that.
Right.
Isn't he an Oscar winner?
He is an Oscar winner.
Yes.
What is it for? No, it's for a documentary.
Live action short,
right?
Or something?
Oh, I thought
or
it was a documentary short. Oh, maybe. I don't know. Yes, he is an Oscar winner.
He was dating Michelle Pfeiffer at her.
He won for documentary feature.
Feature, right? Yeah.
Yeah.
Was it for The Cove? Am I right
about
that?
The Cove, yeah.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. 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 Yep.
God bless him. I mean, what a time. And if you look at what Michael Keaton is wearing to the Oscars, by the way, it's like jeans, a black blazer, a red tie over, like, a denim shirt. It's just like a different time. Just a crazy, crazy, weird thing. But next week on this podcast, we are covering Muppet Christmas Carol with Tom Bison and Clay Keller. Do you, Chris, Joe, have thoughts on Muppet Christmas Carol?
I'm less of a Muppet person than you might expect, given my age bracket and whatnot.
Sure.
I watched Muppet Christmas Carol again last Christmas, though, and it is a perfectly lovely version of A Christmas Carol. Like, genuinely, like, I mean that. It's the funniest Muppet movie because of what it's adapting, it sidelines Miss Piggy way more than any other Muppet movie. And it's kind of funny in that regard. It's like, it's so weird to just like, oh, she's just really just playing a wife, huh? Like, okay, there we go. But
it kind of sidelines a lot of the Muppets in a weird way.
It does kind of, actually. But, you know, it's a good movie. I like it.
That's a good movie. Chris, do you have thoughts on the Muppet Christmas Carol?
The one, the like floating ghost is...
Yeah. Fucking scary.
One of the scariest fucking things I've ever seen in my life. Truly burn all celluloid prints of that with fire. Just kidding, never do that. Not nearly my favorite Muppet movie, but I'm so glad that we have that. The Muppets should be adapting all everything. Types of Dickens and, you know, every movie that has had like too many remakes of it, we need a Muppet version of it too. We need a Muppet Star is Born. We need
Pride and Prejudice.
We need a Muppet Pride and Prejudice.
Pride and Prejudice and Gonzo. Yeah, exactly.
I don't disagree.
When it comes to like riffs on A Christmas Carol, I was very much a Mickey's Christmas Carol person every year.
Yes.
Mickey's Christmas Carol is wonderful. Christmas Carol.
That was mine.
I actually,
and it's like 20 minutes.
Yeah. I you know what? I feel like if the Muppets were to revive their signature variety series, you two guys would be great guests. I think you'd be amazing guest
Thank
hosts.
Thank you.
Yeah.
I agree.
That is truly the best compliment I have ever received in my life.
I would just flirt with Scooter all the time, like, is the thing. So, like, I would probably get, like, nothing done the rest of the show. It would just be, like, me just trying to, like, smooth on Scooter. So, yeah.
I would spend way too much time worried about whether or not Janice thought I was cool.
That would be, that would be such, you know how they always had these like runner plots for the hosts and Muppet Show? Sure. Such a great plot is Joe is so busy flirting with Scooter that he doesn't make it out for the bits, and like Chris is left alone being like, where's Joe? Like trying, like really putting his all into it. I'm gonna write this episode of television. This is gonna be my Muppet spec.
Sounds incredible. Thank you both so much for being here to talk about one of my favorite movies. Please plug your podcast. Tell people where they can hear your podcast.
This at Oscar Buzz, we talk about movies that were positioned for Oscars and didn't quite get there. We have very recently had the great Emily St. James on to talk about Moby Dick and all that implied. It was such a fun one. It was really great.
It was a blast.
I had such a great time. It was such a fun, and like you guys were like, here's the list of movies we're thinking about, and I was like, what about Moby Dick?
It was really, really like,
we read that email and was like, yes, obviously we're doing this.
Yeah. And then Chris, you can tell them all about our Patreon, where they can join up for $5 a month.
Yeah, you can subscribe to us on Patreon. We do for $5 a month. We have two bonus episodes on top of the main feed. First episode comes out the first of the month. That's what we call our exception episodes, movies that really fit our rubric but managed to get some Oscar nominations. Then we do what we call exception on the 15th of the month. It's just kind of like a deep dive into obsessions we have, whether it's actress roundtables, recapping award shows, things like that.
I have one last question for you guys. I'd be remiss if I didn't ask you an Oscar question as we wrap this up.
Yeah.
What is your like crazy outlier movie that you think has a shot at getting Best Picture that no one thinks has a shot? Like, what is the sort of what's the surprise nomination for you guys, I guess, is ultimately
Joe has an answer for this.
Wait, what's my answer for this? What is my answer?
Your answer for this is Air.
Oh, well, that except
it's the closest thing to, I think, like a surprise out that's of nowhere.
And I don't even think it's, and also I don't like that movie. That's me just like being a pessimist. But that's like not even that out of the ordinary. I'm trying to think of like what would be like a truly wild yet like quasi plausible.
It doesn't need to be Best Picture.
I want to believe that we could see Todd Haynes' film be nominated for Best Picture again. The signs are pointing in that direction, but
Chris has been hurt before, and
I've been regularly hurt. The wound is still fresh.
It is crazy that Carol didn't get a Best Picture nomination. Like, that's insane.
It got everything well, but basically. Yeah,
they, didn't, right. they just yeah. they don't respect the lesbians is what That's is true. The truth of it. Yeah. I made December's my favorite of the year so far.
Same.
So I'm like I'm hopeful too. I saw that Godzilla Minus One made the visual effects shortlist, and I'm like, I hope that movie has such good visual effects on a budget. That's my like, I hope that gets in there. I know
I love
it won't,
that
but
your Letterboxd review for that movie is tremendous. Yeah. That you came home and Libby was like, are you crying because of the Godzilla movie?
I was.
Excellent. Well, thank you so much, guys. This was an absolute blast. We can't wait to have you guys on again in the future. And, you know, thank you so much.
Before you go, I do want to say they sent out so many screeners for Air, and both Libby and I are in WGA, and I was in Gallica, and I'm no longer because I'm not a critic anymore, but like they still think I am, so I get all the screeners for that.
Very good.
We've gotten fully 9 screeners of Air at this point, and
it's going to be an original screenplay nominee.
For a while, my daughter, one of the things that would pacify her was if we gave her an Air screener and we would just push her on her stroller and she would just like look at it and be like, oh, like there's the stars of Air. I don't know what it was.
I wonder how that's going to manifest in your child's life later on. Like that's one of those things where like that is a seed planted and I don't know how it sprouts, but like
someday she's gonna like bring home a boyfriend who's gonna look just like Matt Damon in that
or just
movie.
Get really like, oh. into tracksuits yep. for a while yep. like yep. something
that movie it's hard for me to have feelings one way or another about that movie. Like I think that there was some stuff in it that I thought was kind of cute. It kind of had like a nice dad vibe to it, but like it's not a it doesn't feel like a particularly like special movie. I don't
It's also Michael like Jordan for all the song. Movies that get shit for like having like constant needle drops that are just so annoying.
Well, yeah.
Nobody ever like complained about that with Air. And I'm like, that I felt
yeah. it's the worst, most egregious example of that.
It is. Yeah. It really is.
I don't disagree. But, you know, listen, Air may be a Best Picture nominee. Well, who knows? Yeah. Thank you so much for doing this. And I can't wait to talk to you guys in the future.
All right. Bye bye.
Hey everyone, Phil again. So here's the interview I did with Daniel Waters, the one of the screenwriters of Batman Returns. I hope you enjoy it. With me right now is the screenwriter, or I guess technically speaking, one of the screenwriters of Batman Returns. But we'll get into that because I have questions about all of the various workings.
All I know is there's only one person who has a screenplay credit on the poster.
Right. And that person is with me right now, and that is Daniel Waters, to talk about Batman Returns, my favorite Batman movie. So,
all right, what cool. it's worth.
I want to kind of, I'm going to
write,
back.
By the yeah. way, I write great arbitration letters. That's why I'm so excited. I've joked that the best piece of writing ever done in a Batman movie was my arbitration letter, but that's another story.
Well, I'd like to hear some of that story, but I want to kind of rewind for a second. How did Batman Returns, how did you come into this project? How did this project come into your life?
Well, I've always loved Batman. And I really wanted, wrong answer. It's sad that one person, one male in America who never wanted to write a Batman movie gets to write a Batman movie. So,
but writes maybe the best one. So there you go. Yeah.
Oh, stop, Phil.
I'm serious. I think my point, not to up your ass, is more that the distance you had from the source material probably gave you the ability to be able to, you know, write a different type of Batman movie.
Yeah, it's crazy to think about what a luxury of freedom we had now that you have to go through a Politburo and a tribunal over every line in a superhero movie, that we were just fucking around, and you know, I had come in to meet Tim about Denise Dovey had become mm-hmm. Tim's producing partner, and she produced a little my little debut film Heathers, mm-hmm. which Tim seemed to have a liking for, and so. He was looking for a writer for Beetlejuice 2. I didn't have an idea for Beetlejuice 2. I guess they're finally doing it, but yeah, not that, much, yeah. nothing with me. But but she said, just come in to meet Tim anyway, just to meet him. I had a half-ass quasi-pitch about Beetlejuice and the first family in the United States in the the White House and all that, but
amazing.
We
would watch.
We quickly went. We ended up being just a general meeting, and it ended up being good. And then I ended up in Rome and Budapest doing Hudson Hawk, and
so also like, quite frankly, an underrated movie. But
how can it not be underrated? It's certainly there's no way to rate it lower.
It's fair.
Well, yes. When I think I've revealed that when I'm drunk, I like to Google Daniel Waters underrated and see what comes up. And
you
get a lot of hits.
For Hudson Hawk.
Hudson Hawk and Demolition Man.
Demolition Man.
And even Ford Fairlane's got a couple of lovers.
Yeah.
But you know, talk about a movie like who do I have to fuck to get off this picture? Like, and then I get the phone call of like Tim wants to meet about Batman Returns, like Roadrunner, like shoo out of like my notepad for Hudson Hawk hanging in the air out of frame as I zoom away. And again, I didn't really have. I worshiped The Dark Knight Returns, the Frank Miller thing.
Sure.
And so that was something I loved, and I loved that world and that ambiance. I was kind of disappointed when I saw Tim's first Batman. I thought it was just beautiful, but kind of just lied there story wise and character wise. Sure. And so I didn't have any, and it turned out Tim didn't have much love for it either, so it didn't cost me in the room. But but I did, like, I love Frank Miller, and I loved, he has a book, Electra Assassin and Electra, and like I love it. And I was obsessed with, I wouldn't say strong female role, because it's become such a cliche and it's become such an abused term, but I love anytime you make a woman the center of your film or the center of your story, and you give her a sense of humor, and you give her, like, you don't just make her a man with a vagina, you give her own, like, and so I'd been reading books like Women Ride with the Wolves, Run with the Wolves, and always been reading female psychology. So I came in guns a-blazing on Catwoman.
Sure.
And so immediately I had pictures of Catwoman that immediately, like, okay, Tim just went for it, and like, okay, fine, like, I got the job without even knowing I had the job, without really saying much about Batman, but I sure said a lot about Catwoman.
But I mean, it does feel like, you know, the sort of enduring part of this movie, and I think there's lots of them, but I do think the Catwoman was probably at the top of that list, in terms of, you know, Michelle's incredible performance, but also just in terms of what you were talking about, the feminism of the character, the fact that she wasn't just this sort of slinky, sexy thing, you know, she was closer to sort of a vigilante, for lack of a better way of putting it.
She wasn't just about kicking ass. I mean, it was
right.
She was unpredictable. And when's the last time you can say that about any kind of superhero movie, but,
right.
Yeah, and there was an existing script that Sam Hamm, mm-hmm. which had Catwoman and Penguin as the villain characters, so that got him story credit right there, even though we didn't use a word of the script. But it was like a Hardy Boys adventure. It was just a good old fashioned, lots of plot, which me and Tim really love. Lots of plot. A well-oiled Swiss watch, like, just the kind of stuff. And, you know,
Sam did do a version of the first Batman movie as well. So I imagine he was just kind of brought on for the sequel. And
yes. And it was like, Tim, I mean, it's a solid script. Tim read it. And, you know, I read it through Tim's eyes, and I go, there's no way he's going to do this.
Right.
This is like, you know, the Lewis Teague version, or the, you know, Peter Hyams version, put it better.
Well, I mean, from the research that I've done, and just over the years, and my love for this movie, you know, for all intents and purposes, Tim Burton seemed pretty uninterested in doing a sequel, just kind of off the face of it seemed to him, why do sequels? Like, again, this was before sequels were really what they are now. So to him, it was just like, I don't want to just do this again. Like, the only reason to do this is to bring something new to the table, which is why and I say this with no, you know, denigration to Sam Hamm as a writer, I feel like he was screwed from the jump, right? Like there was no way.
Yeah, no, I have a feeling he just like, I'm sure he got paid nicely for the draft, but I'm sure he felt like it was going to be a sacrificial lamb, because it did solidify that Tim didn't want to do the movie. But
so Tim and you meet, and obviously you read the script, and sort of, I guess I'm curious as to like these two minds, you and Tim, what was sort of the.
Well, I always joke that it's like Rain Man with two Dustin Hoffmans. Like, because it's like usually you get the Tom Cruise to work with,
yeah,
Tim, and this is the time like, wait, there's another fucking weirdo who's used to doing all the weirdo tricks that you do in a room with people, like, oh, that he's weird, he's an artist, so we have to pay attention to him. But like, we both have that fake artist side, and yeah, like I always compare Tim to Bjork, where Bjork will do these interviews. I love the sprinkles in the air, and then when she gets in the studio, like, can we bring that down 12 dBs?
I mean, you're speaking my language. Tim Burton and Bjork are two of my favorite things, but I'll just say that that this speaks to how bulletproof Tim Burton is at this moment in his career, right? I mean, he's just cashed one of his blank checks to make Edward Scissorhands. And then he brings you on to this film, which in and of itself, I imagine, is also a pretty, and I say this obviously with love for your work, but a pretty ballsy move, right? To bring someone in as esoteric and dark and kind of twisted as your writing can be. Warner Brothers, did they push back on this at all? I'm assuming they were just like, go for it.
Yeah, and Denise obviously vouched for me too. But I think they knew going in that the first film was a Batman movie directed by Tim Burton. And this, whether you like it or not, was going to be a Tim Burton movie that happened to involve Batman.
Yeah, sure. Which I'm sure Michael Keaton loved.
Well, Michael Keaton had his own Batman, and I get accused of making Batman like a supporting Burt Young character in this, and like Michael has a way of paring down everything. Like I was a little satirical and fun in my two first drafts. Like my first draft opened with the Batman logo, and then you pull out from the Batman logo and it's a merchandising store, and then the entire merchandising store blows up and it's being attacked, and that's where the movie begins. And so I
want to ask about this version, because there's
Michael Keaton has a lot of speeches about mugs, like, how dare you make a Batman mug.
So there's a lot of stuff online about your early drafts of this script, which Lord knows I would love to read someday. But there's apparently a 160 page first draft is what you claimed potentially was.
Well, the first draft of Heather's was 215. So I'm getting more mature. So that makes sense. That was 160 pages. Yeah, I mean, I'm always a big believer in getting the world out there, and like, and then, and it's not like it's all going to be golden. Mm-hmm. But you know, just to, don't hold back on the first draft. Give me my first draft. Don't make me do pages. Just let me have my play in the fields of the Lord for a while. But
sure, I think a lot of writers are similar to you, which is it's easier to go too far and get pulled back than it is sort of to incrementally get pushed. You know what I mean? Like, I think that
some writers can't help themselves. They have 85 page first drafts, and I want to slap them. Like, it only took me 2 weeks to write that. Oh, you're bragging about that? Like, it's like, it only took me 10 seconds to have sex. Like, you know, why are you bragging about this?
So you read Sam Hamm's draft and you start from scratch, right?
It's codified. It's in the language that Catwoman, Penguin are going to be in this. And so Catwoman, I came away with like right away with the take. So much worked out, and a lot of working with Tim Burton is, you know, I always say Tim Burton is a fairy tale, and that you're the innocent trying to please the magical prince. And there comes a point, and you can see it, there's a switch that goes on when Tim likes something, and he almost wants to he almost wants you to get the fuck out of the room when it happens, because he's just like, okay, you have turned on the Tim, you've turned on the Burton machine. I get the fuck out of here and let me Burton. Like you know, I did a thing with, like, I wanted Catwoman to be homemade. I didn't want her to be like that she creates a costume in a sewing machine. And that, you know, even then, I had one of the scenes I really love in the movie is Batman goes in his Batcave and he has all his bat suits. And meanwhile, Catwoman is crawling, reaching in her pizza box to pull out her Catwoman suit. Like, that image was with me from the beginning. And he immediately started drawing and, like, drew this homemade Catwoman suit that was better than anything I actually imagined. And so it's like, okay.
I mean, that's definitely one of the best scenes in the movie. Her sort of, and I hate to say breakdown because that makes it seem, you know, negative, but her sort of birth sequence, if you will, brings me to sort of a question that I have for you in terms of the duality, the mental health component that exists in this film. You know, you got a lot of people that are struggling with the two sides, the not even the good and evil, but just sort of the presentable and the unpresentable, if you will.
I thought it was a compliment in quotations that Britney Spears was on Instagram last year talking about that scene, saying it's the best scene in film history. And I'm like, is this who I want backing me up on this? But
listen, pretty yes, great.
Yes. Sure. Yeah. Yeah. And I do. Yeah. I mean, she knows a lot about duality. Like, sure. when you're going out with women in LA, I say, oh, they're bipolar? Only two? This is good.
So did you?
Yeah, did yes. You so obviously, I wanted to, like, yeah. The thing I like about the movie in general is that no two people have the same opinion of the movie. That there's, like, I think Marvel movies, whether you like them or not, they hit you the same way. Even if you love them, they hit you the same way. You don't. There's no arguing about the details. Like this, like, you try to get under. It's not all on the surface. You try to make the text subtext in many ways, where you want this creepiness to come out of it more than it would in a normal commercial movie. And so, like, I just embraced everything. Anytime I thought that she was too strong or too weak, I would turn it the other way and just make it fucked up and confusing. Like, I also love that the movie, she's Michelle Pfeiffer, she's a star, but she doesn't get a close-up in her first scene. Like she's just walking into the background smoking, pouring coffee. Like, I like that. And I like that, you know. So that breakdown scene is, and as the Batman people will complain, it's like, it's a great scene, but it happens before we really even talk to Batman. So fuck you, why are you doing this? But that's the game we're playing here.
So when you're writing this, were there performances or movies that were inspiration to you? Because I know, obviously, the comics, for all intents and purposes, you know, not really your bag.
But yeah, like I said, I love Frank Miller's Dark Knight Returns and loved Electric Assassin. I thought they had a different kind of texture.
Sure.
I'm always bad at answering a question. It's like it's why I've never had a TV show on TV. Like, I'd give these great TV pitches, and then they ask you, "Well, what other hit shows is this like?" And I'm like, "Ah."
I'm not trying to put you on the spot.
No, if I could think of a TV show was like, I wouldn't have written it. That's what I try to say. Everybody in the room laughs, and they don't buy it.
Sure. I mean,
I mean, obviously, we're going for, you know. Like, it was a Tim Burton that I wanted to do the Tim Burton movie that hadn't been made. And like, and sure. Tim and I would talk about Fellini. We would talk about, you know, the operatic grand artist. And it was funny. Like, I would talk about my favorite Fellini films, and he didn't have a favorite Fellini film. He just thought all Fellini films were the same Fellini film. And just, he loved that world. And sure. he didn't break it down in plot and story and things like that. So I knew he had this artistic zone that he hadn't really played with. And I was like, well, I'll keep one foot into the fact we're making a commercial superhero movie for Warner Brothers, but I'm going to try and get weird and see if I can outweird Tim Burton. I never really did, but the fact that I tried to outweird him, he appreciated.
It's commendable.
Like, people ask, did he tell you to name Christopher Walken character Max Schrecka? Like, we've never discussed. I just knew I was working for Tim Burton. I knew he would love that I named it Max Schreck, but he never complimented me. He just, Max Schreck was on the call sheet. But I could tell, like, it's a little thing to do when you work for Tim Burton. You know, it's a little different with Ron Howard.
I don't doubt that. I think that, you know, one of the things that Tim Burton, I think, gets dinged with as a filmmaker is, you know, style over substance. And I think ultimately that comes back to sort of what you're talking about, which is that I think he's a lot more of a vibe filmmaker than people give credence to.
Yes. And that's kind of what the movie we wanted to make. We wanted to make these strange characters, inner, like their neurons and molecules that bounce off each other, and let's see what happens from there. Instead of a plotty McPlot, you know, the special guest star, Wesley Strick, who we'll bring up later, he came in and put in a plot of like the firstborn children of Gotham City or some shit like that. I mean, I love what Wesley did, but I mean, I was a little hard at it. I would make jokes to all my friends and at the time, but now that I've been rewritten by scoundrels, I've learned to really appreciate Wesley Strick. So, and Wesley, if you're listening to this, and you're probably not, I apologize. And people compliment me all the time on Unlimited Poontang, and I tell them you wrote it. So I anytime
that was his line, that wasn't your line.
That's his line. For some reason, everybody's got to tell me how it's the best line I've ever written. It's like I didn't write it. God damn it!
I'll just say this though, it's crazy that exists in the movie. Like, it's crazy that in 1992, in a movie meant for kids, you had Chris Walken say to a penguin-ify Danny DeVito, Unlimited Poontang. It is an insane thing. Like,
well, yeah, I had a different pussy. I think we all had different pussy lines, but...
Well, sure, you had a Catwoman. Like, how could you...
Yeah, but even that just always makes me cough on my Coke Zero when I see that.
Sure.
Just the pussy I'm looking for. Hey. So, well, it's what I love about the movie is that, I mean, Christopher Nolan, bless his soul, I love Dark Knight, and I love Dark Knight. Nobody liked Dark Knight Rises more than me. And he blows up football fields, like Matt Reeves blows up a convention center. Mm-hmm. Extreme violence in all the other Batman movies. And yet people were more freaked out by Danny DeVito eating a fish and biting a nose like that. Like we had babies and toys and clowns and Christmas and rubber ducks. And we really know, me and Tim really know how to fuck with your head. These people who are doing generic violence, that's nothing. But you get into what kids really associate with and then flip their brains. That's much more devious and nasty.
It is interesting how the reception of this film was divisive, we'll just say.
Yes.
I was 12 when this movie came out, and I saw it in theaters, and I remember just not really getting it. And in the years that came after it, it's, as I said, become one of, if not my favorite Batman movie, because... It's first of all, it's pushing your notions of what people are doing within these comic book kind of tropes. But I would also say, too, like, it's just not pulling its punches. And I feel like so many comic movies do that today.
Yes, it's not true. It's unfortunately not, you know, much to some people's chagrin, it's not trying to please anybody except me and Tim. Like, you know, like we think people cringing and gasping is like, it's working.
You know, it's funny. Last night, I went to a screening of Poor Things, which I don't know if you've seen it yet.
I haven't seen it. Dying to.
But I'm very curious to hear your thoughts on it because, you know, you'll see. That being said, it was one of those films where it was a guild screening. The movie ends, and as are most of these guild screenings, there's applause, generally speaking, right? Because people feel like, you know, obligated. It was... the strangest applause I've ever, like, people clearly did not know how to process what they had just seen, which was just great. It was, and I imagine Batman Returns somewhat similar, right? People are going in to see a Happy Meal movie and they leave with, you know, Danny DeVito spitting up bile for 2 hours. It's great.
Yeah, I did feel a little bad. I mean, for the kids. but you know, but like even 12-year-old Philip, mm-hmm. you know, we'll get you later. You'll come around. Like, I mean, that's why, you know, Marvel never brings any kind of sexuality in the mix. Yeah. And you bring just a little bit of it. It's like green pepper. It's all going to taste like sexuality. And that,
I mean, I don't think DC has much sexuality in their films either, to be clear.
Yeah, no, I mean, no.
It's, you know, I you know,
this is something funny that I didn't find out until recently that and people, David Goyer and Nolan and people who don't like Batman Returns will seize on this little statement, but I didn't know DC standard for Detective Comics.
You know what? I think when you, as you just said it, I was like, I think I might have known that, but I don't think I, like, it just wasn't. And it's also, why is it just called Detective Comics? That doesn't, they're not all detectives.
Yeah, but yeah, I think the first thing I ever said on Twitter was when the Batman came out, and I said, so you're telling me he's a detective?
For 3 hours, they're telling you he's a detective.
Yeah, which I don't. I'll brag about Batman. I'll brag about Catwoman. I'll brag about even a lot of Penguin's character. I won't brag about my detective skills or giving Batman detective skills.
Yeah,
it's not his best detective work. Here's the problem. It was only the second Batman movie, and so we got hit by Batman fans for breaking so many rules. But now that there's been 700 superhero movies and 50 Batman movies, yeah, I think we're getting a new sense of like, hey, look at that second. Let's go back and look at that second Batman. It was something different. It was like, oh my God, it doesn't have any of these things we've seen 1,000 times. So I think it's getting definitely a newfound appreciation. Like I saw the 30th anniversary screening that was last year, and I was like, oh my God, this is the way it's supposed to play.
People love it. I mean, it's crazy. I mean, it is a crazy movie. Every time I watch it, I'm filled with glee that it exists, because it is a movie that feels like a miracle, as far as I'm concerned. That this had sort of, that Tim had the wind at his back to be able to do this, that Warner Brothers was so kind of gaga over the potential of Batman that they were willing to be like, well, he did a great job on the first one and that made $1 billion. So how could we go wrong? And then to see sort of this overcorrection. And I like the Schumacher movies, to be clear. I think they're fun, but I mean, I also just think that they're really goofy and they're kind of harking back to the, you know, OG television show in a lot of ways. But so when you were brought on, this was already a Christmas movie, correct? So in the Sam Hamm version,
it was not a Christmas movie.
Was it?
You know, I always wanted, because it, I think it was one of those Tim unceremoniously told me it was a Christmas movie. Maybe it was in Sam Hamm's draft, but in my first draft, I guess my first draft it was, because I had the mistletoe line right away, but it was something like, him just, we're gonna make it Christmas, like, and I'm always up for Christmas, like, Christmas gives you all this extra juice, and like, you know, nothing like a summer Christmas movie. My brother made a summer Christmas movie too, Mr. Popper's Penguins. It's just like we share that.
So, but I bring up the Christmas thing because this episode is dropping in December, and we're doing a whole bunch of Christmas films from 92. We're doing this, and
I love the fact it's become a Christmas movie. It's shows in theater. Like, I already got sold out of two screenings of the Alamo Drafthouse, and I'm missing a Queer in Film seminar that goes with the movie. Like, so it's Queer in Film and Christmas, and I'm missing it all.
So you mentioned the mistletoe line, which is definitely one of my favorite lines in the film.
It gets sold really well.
It gets sold.
It was a little clunky on the paper.
It sold really well twice, right? It sold really well the first time.
I can't believe how much of my favorite stuff and probably most people's favorite stuff was shit that I came up with in the first meeting. Like, we got to have a masquerade ball. We're the only ones not wearing costumes. Like, you know, it's just like, and you know, my crass pitch became something absolutely sublime.
Yeah, I mean, it's funny you say that like on the page it might have felt a little bit clunky, but it's also kind of a skeleton key. It's the reveal line, right? Like it has to be such a good line so that we remember it when it comes back.
Well, clunky always stays in your memory too, but I'll take your version.
But I think about, you know, their kiss or when she licks him, which is a moment that everyone remembers. Their kiss under the mistletoe, if you will. And then you have the masquerade ball where they say the same line again.
Apparently we turn young women into lesbians according to the program for the screening. So
I mean, Michelle Pfeiffer could turn anyone into anything, quite frankly. I mean, I'm just for what it's worth. I think it's interesting. First of all, here's a question for you. Speaking of the masquerade ball, the semi-hard, I'd say, is that your line?
That's Strix. Strix a dirty boy.
Strix is super horny.
It's so funny because Strix was, I like to think he was much more of a normal writer than they thought. Well, Dan Juan is probably mostly the first credit anyway, so I'll just get perverted and everyone will assume it's Waters because he's a big perv.
That's amazing. Because I assumed. Like, how would I not assume, right? I mean,
I thought it was a little the wrong moment for vulgarity, but you know, but Michelle sold it.
That's for sure. Michelle sells everything in this movie. But okay, so I want to ask about the Wesley Strick stuff. Okay,
we're not going to talk about Penguin.
We'll talk about Penguin, but we're talking about Strick. So I figure we'll talk about Strick and then we'll go back to Penguin. But okay. So I don't know. We don't need to get into it, but you and Tim go your separate ways, it seems.
Sure. My contract was kind of over.
Okay.
And I was surprised I wasn't rehired. Okay. And when I read Wesley's first draft, like it was obviously kept in the loop that it let me read his first draft. His first draft had a lot I didn't like.
Okay.
A lot I didn't like. And I didn't react too well to it. And there's this song by Paul Abdul, Blow Kisses in the Wind, that I was listening to when I read the most grueling passages of the Strix first draft. And so now you should see me when that song comes. It's not one of the most popular songs, but it's a great song. But when it comes on, I just turn into like the Manchurian Candidate. I just start sweating in a fetal position and run by firearms and just take out 10 people. But
so did you get his stuff lifted? Were you able to do a rewrite or how did that work?
Well, I don't know if you've heard the tale of the fax machine.
No.
Warner Brothers gave me a fax machine and I sent a 17-page tirade against this draft, which is again not recommended for you young writers coming up.
That's a great idea. Yeah.
And then I got a note back from the fax machine that 16 pages had gone through of the 17. So it's like I didn't know which page did go through, so I had to send it, the whole thing again, which they took as like just like one send a 17 page fax once, shame on you. Send 17 page twice and like, you fucking psychopath. So that wasn't great, but some of it sunk through, like what I didn't like, and then I don't even remember. There was scenes of the Murphy bed flinging up and Max Schreck's son Chip getting put in the wall and like, oh my god. Anyway, Wesley did a great job. It was the first draft, it was just like the Rain Man with two Dustin Hoffmans. We needed a Tom Cruise. He was our Tom Cruise. He put the trains on in time. He gave that, you know, Firstborn to Gotham City thing, which is not anything anybody talks about. It's not what you come humming. You don't hum that song walking out of the movie. But it is a bit of a handrail. It is like, you know, Sid Field, Robert McKee, a handrail for some people. I didn't think we needed it. I was ready to go full Altman.
Have the Penguin? Did the Penguin have a mission in your draft? Like, did the Penguin have a goal other than fucking Catwoman?
Yeah, he did want people to love him. He did want that whole ingratiating thing, and then the running for, like, Max Schreck using him to run for mayor, and that falling apart. Tim and I had a very funny experience. We'll go back to Wesley if you must. But Penguin was like, we never really got Penguin. As far as like, well, who's Penguin supposed to be? Supposed to be a gangster? He's like, he wears wears those top hats and like
monocles
and cigarette lighters. And like, I've already done my monocle movie with Tethers. But we did. And he was so weird looking that we didn't even know he's human. And then Tim had all these drawings of the hideous Penguin boy, and we're like, why don't we just make him that? And then at the time, like, I think it was not that far from the LA riots that this happened. I just liked the idea of what if somebody wanted to run for mayor, so they caused the LA riots. And so they can run for that. So I had that kernel of thought and was always going to.
Why don't more infant formula companies use organic, grass-fed whole milk instead of skim? Why don't more infant formula companies use the latest breast milk science? Why don't more infant formula companies run their own clinical trials? Why don't more infant formula companies use more of the proteins found in breast milk? Why don't more infant formula companies have their own factories instead of outsourcing their manufacturing? We wondered the same thing. So we made ByHeart, a better formula for formula. Learn more at ByHeart.com.
Planning for your next trip? Elevate your travel style with Quince. Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/trip for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Ever catch yourself eating the same flavorless dinner 3 days in a row? Dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic-butter shrimp scampi. Hello Fresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.
I always thought Max Schreck was actually an intentionally much more duller Mitt Romney character. And I wanted like the banality of him to be the banality of evil, and like that these fucked up multi-dimensional villains are not the real villains, and it's just the guy who never has a moment of self-doubt, like the Donald Trump character way before Donald Trump, or way before Donald Trump became president, that he's the true evil. So I wanted him to be the master manipulator so at the end, like, it's much more like it is in the movie, which more of Penguin's final act of desperation. I mean, another core line that we developed from the beginning was the flip on the Elephant Man of like, and Raging Bull of, I'm not a human being, I'm an animal. And that was another key. Yeah, I mean, the again, you're waiting for that Tim Burton far away look of like, I'm burning, I'm burning, I'm burning. And like that. And also, I think I told him like, what, you know, the stockbrokers and business mavens around the world are shredding their documents, and here's the guy in the sewer taping the documents together. And Tim was like, leave me. Got it. Now we will begin. The process will begin.
There was a rumor, and I'm curious if there's any legitimacy to this, that you and Tim Burton considered doing a Catwoman movie together. Is that true?
We developed a Catwoman movie. I mean, it's funny. We We smoked the peace pipe and developed the Catwoman movie. It's weird. We didn't really listen to each other. Like he wanted to do a kind of low budget black and white Selena Kyle in a small town cat people, like the original cat people type movie. And I want to, and this was like, okay, really complete. Like he would show me Ann Margaret movies, like Kitten and the Whip, like, and the original cat people and Curse of the Cat People, like just kind of small time. And like, I nodded my head. And then I would like, I made the biggest, most bombastic Catwoman script. And I gave him this outline for it and he didn't say anything. And I thought that was approval of the outline. And then I wrote the script and like, yeah, it's too much like the outline. Like what the hell? But it was almost like a Batman movie. And the tone was very much like The Boys, where she moves to a small city in the, like I wanted the sun-stroked Arizona version of Gotham City, like the LA of Gotham City. Mm-hmm. And it's run by these three macho superheroes. And so like The Boys, the superheroes are kind of the assholes and she's got to like break out the Catwoman gear and fight them. And like, you know, all I did was the first draft before everybody realized Tim realized he didn't really want to do a Catwoman movie. But Michelle Pfeiffer saw me at a party and she almost clawed me. She thought she Lee Harvey Oswald me as I'm the one who messed up the project. But I'm a patsy.
I think today, and I'm sure no one will ever make this movie, but you could do Michelle Pfeiffer, Michael Keaton, aged versions of Bruce Wayne and Selena Kyle. I mean, you could do that today and people would fucking watch that. Like, I think that, I mean, listen, I understand that Michelle still has the Catwoman costume. She still has her whip. She, you know, whips it out on social media from time to time. I'm sure she still looks great in it. I have no doubt that
yeah, absolutely.
So there is just a part of me that's like, I think that hopefully, you know, once the fever breaks and we don't make nearly as many of these comic book movies and there's sort of maybe a little bit more wiggle room, I do wonder whether or not there's a way to go back to that.
Coming off The Flash, we're gold.
Yeah, we're good, right? We're fine. Everything's great. You get the Wesley Strick script. He goes to set, I'm assuming. He's the one who covers the...
Yes, I visited the set twice. It was much like the scene Silence of the Lambs where I'm wheeled out in the Silence of the Lambs outfit and wheeled around the set. But I did go to the set a couple times. But yes, Wesley was the production writer. Wesley got to have cider at the wrap party.
So
but I'm yeah. You'd rather have my credit though.
My question is, in terms of, because I don't work in features, I work in television, and things are very, as you know, very different in TV than they are in features. Was this a locked script when it went to picture? Like when you guys actually started to shoot this thing, was there rewrites happening on like
I'm sure today? I mean, like, the core things have always been there from the beginning, but I'm sure there was little rewrites always here and there. And like, and definitely, like I said, I wrote Christopher Walken. Christopher Walken was number one on my casting list, but for a totally different version of Max Schreck. And he kind of became like, you know, he saw how everybody else is having fun. So I think he upped the fun quotient of the role. And I think there was a lot of, rewriting done for his character to make him more lively and fun. Although, you know, it's like it's like I say Wesley Strick did he didn't do like a lot of rewriters do of just like, okay, it's mine now, I'm gonna blow up everything.
The reason I bring up the whole like locked idea is, again, this is before we have the shit shows that we have now, right? Where
yeah, that's the thing. Grading on a curve with today, it's nothing like it.
Right. Where, you know, you've got Marvel writing scenes on the day, doing massive amounts of reshoots. Like it just, there were no reshoots on this, I'm assuming, or maybe there were, I don't know.
I think they're probably, I mean, there wasn't like let's reshoot an entire right. scene, but there's always something needed to embellish.
Sure, sure.
Not a cheap movie, Batman Returns.
Not a cheap movie. You know, I also think it's worth noting too, and not to state the obvious, but you know, obviously there's a lot of German expressionism going on in this movie. I mean, that you were both sort of, you and Burton were very inspired by the aesthetics and the kind of vibe of those films as well, I'm assuming.
Yeah, that first shot of the town plaza, I'm like, whoa, okay, you weren't kidding. Guess that German expressionism aftertaste you wanted became the meal. Thank God I named the character Max Schreck. Like,
so during the you mentioned that during the writing process that Tim was involved, and I'm sort of curious as to what that relationship was like in the sense of.
Well, I mean, when I actually went off to write, I went off the right. Like, I didn't give him pages or anything like that, but just in the development of what he wanted, like I said, you know, you try to get that vibe from him, you try to capture that look, and then he would draw things. Like I told, like I had this conception of the way the villains, like I had a different, I had like kind of artistic art students as weirdly surreal art students as Penguin's henchmen. Mm-hmm. Like they would play all these practical trips. Like I always wanted to do a movie where they have the don't walk button you press before you cross the street, mm-hmm. and they set it so the 1,780th person who presses the button will blow up. And
sure.
I love this stuff, but he's like, yeah, just make them clowns. So this is kind of nuts. Tim likes clowns. Tim likes clowns. Yeah.
But I mean, you say clowns and people will think one thing. This is more like, my
Yeah, he said clowns, and he gave me the book Geek Love by Catherine Dunn. So it's not like exactly. it ain't Bozo's grand prize game, right?
I still think that he should make that book. I mean, I don't know why he has not just made that book into a TV show.
I mean, well, my dream is always I want to do Burton's Armacord. Like, I think he's got that great Fellini in him. Like, let's go full artistic.
But instead, we're getting Beetlejuice too. So, you know, you take what you can get, I guess. So, I mean, I don't know. I think he's one of those guys who I really feel does do the, not one for them, one for me, but like once he has a hit, then he takes a swing. And generally that swing doesn't connect. And then he has to go do another hit. Do you know what I'm saying? Like, I feel
up
and down kind of component to his career. I think it's interesting. I also, you talking about the black and white Catwoman thing makes me think of Ed Wood, which he does shortly after this film. You know what I mean? The whole black and whiteness, the whole sort of that old kind of 50s vibe. It wouldn't make sense for a Catwoman movie, really, because that's not really the vibe of Batman Returns, but I guess that's whatever.
Yeah, I mean, it could have been an interesting movie. I just didn't think anybody wanted to see it, or certainly didn't want to write it. I thought we could come of the best of both worlds, but now that I'm talking about it, I haven't been talked about it in a long time. Now it sounds like shit. Sounds pretty good. Black and white, black and white Senator Kyle. I'd see that for a dollar.
Just a dollar, though.
That's how much it would make.
So, we talked about Christmas.
But love Ed Wood. Ed Wood's probably
you put a gun to my head, it might be my favorite Tim Burton film, but I'm not sure. It depends on any given day.
Written by my best friends, Larry Kierzewski and Scalzander.
Unbelievable writers.
Went to high school there.
Oh, that's awesome. That's super cool. Yeah, I mean, I think Ed Wood is probably, I mean, certainly within film snob circles is the one that everyone kind of points to and goes like, that's the one that I can really get behind, it seems. But you know,
yeah anytime you feel like punching Tim Burton for Miss Peregrine's Dance of the Class of the Swimming, whatever, you're like, well, he did do Ed Wood, so shut the fuck up.
Couldn't have said it better myself. yeah, I so okay. Christmas. Do you have a favorite Christmas movie?
Oh, the big gun. The big gun's the best. The biggie. I watch it every year. The Bim Bam Boomer. Seventh best film of all time. It's a Wonderful Life.
Okay. I was like, what's happening? I mean, it's Wonderful Life. Great movie. Yeah, I mean, can't complain. I get it. I guess my question ultimately is, it's a circuitous way there, but this is a Christmas movie, but I think the reason you get into these weird conversations with people that are very strict about their definitions of Christmas movies, Christmas is not really it doesn't move the story in any real way. It's window dressing. It's just the best kind of window dressing.
Yeah. There's something about Christmas though, that it gives you something to strive against. And also Christmas, I mean, you think of Christmas in a traditional sense of Christmas. Yeah, baby, it's Christmas. But really, deep in your bloodstream, it's associated with melancholy, and you know it's associated with melancholy. And so, like, I wanted that things are not as happy as you think they are vibe. And, like, you came to see a superhero movie. Well, it's not going to be as happy as you think it is. Like, it's a great match with loneliness and then becoming unlonely. That's what Christmas is for. Like, you know, it ain't about kids unwrapping gifts unless it's a giant box that's going to have nasty people jump out of it. Like, you've seen the talk show footage of from the time of the kids crying and like,
oh yeah.
Like, I'm like,
it's the best.
And I'm like, and I'm like, and people are always like sending it to me and like laughing. Look at these stupid kids. Like, these kids aren't stupid. They're right. That's what we wanted to do.
they're reacting exactly as we wanted them to. It's interesting. I remember the McDonald's Happy Meals. I remember I had those plastic cups that had that amazing artwork. There's this amazing designer that did the, you know, I think you know what I'm talking about. They're beautiful. It's all so lovingly made, even if it is a deeply weird film. Do you know, sort of like, there is that push and pull of like, first of all, there's the Christmas of it all. Your three leads have no families. They're all orphans, basically. I mean,
Technically
Selena has a voicemail from her mom, but like, we don't get
that's
the impression
right. They're very that's close. Right.
But there is sort of this, like, they're all sort of these weird, disparate kind of people just floating through space and time. it's kind of sad. But it's really great. I love it, but I do understand why people would leave this film perhaps feeling like, why?
But you're definitely selling the credit, because the Christmas of it, like, it makes you expect, and you know, Christmas is going to heal you in some way. It heals people in the weirdest fucking way in this movie. But the last line, goodwill toward men and women, come on, it's pretty good.
It's great. So you speak of the last line. They spent $1 billion to tag that shot of her
pop. Oh, yes. Right? All my, like, I'm a bit, like I say, I'm a big studier of, I don't even want to call it feminist as much as feminine literature and psychology. And like, I became a little over obsessed with the tragic heroine. And so both from Winona Ryder in Heathers and Michelle Pfeiffer and Catwoman, their characters die. Except they ended up having to rewrite it so they don't die, or they didn't.
Wait, Winona died? Or in your first draft of Heathers, did she die?
Yeah. She's got a bunch of deaths, and she ends up taking the bomb and wearing it in one of my drafts. And
okay.
There's another draft where she goes to say hello to Martha Dumptruck, and Martha Dumptruck stabs her and says, "Fuck you, Heather." And then she's dying with blood coming out of her mouth saying, "My name's not Heather."
That's fantastic. But that's amazing.
They didn't like those endings. And I did have like Selena Kyle lose, like, you know, three, four, four, five still alive.
That's great. You know? I'll save one for next Christmas.
She saved one for next Christmas in my script too, but you didn't see her come back out. And now, like, when I hear people cheering when her head pops back up, I'm like, okay, Warner Brothers know what the fuck they're doing. They know what they're doing. It's like, good for you.
She never appears again. Not as Michelle Pfeiffer, anyway.
Yes, and she was from Halle Berry.
Oh boy, or Anne Hathaway. Let's go with Anne Hathaway. I mean, I think that.
I ended up being the first writer on Catwoman, mm-hmm. and then so there ended up being 36 writers after me, and they like a dump truck dumped like 80 scripts in front of my thing, and like, put them back in the dump truck. I'm not going to arbitrate this. You.
I mean, that movie is obviously a disaster. It's not Halle Berry's fault. It's just that movie is just no good, very bad. Don't do it. But I do wonder. I stand by what I was saying about Michelle Pfeiffer. I think that I still think we could. There's a way to go back to that if someone wanted to. But you write that you attempt the Catwoman thing. Did anyone ever come to you about any other future Batman movies? Was this ever? Was that ever?
Oh no. Only get me. I mean, like, we can talk and hold hands and talk and sing songs of how now the movie's much more respected. But, you know, the movie at the time went, I mean, it started off at an astronomical rate. It broke the record but then it went down 50% like every week because people were not. I mean, the people who liked it, but then the normies, the muggles, they were not digging it. And now, like I said, now the normies are so exhausted by typical superhero movies. Now they're going back and snorting it like cocaine. But at the time, yeah, like I was definitely, Dan Waters will never get near a superhero movie again on Warner Brothers lot. They like what I did with Demolition Man. But
which is also
Warner Brothers came afterwards. And I did like really a 2-week rewrite on it that changed the whole script. So but then I went through a midlife crisis of like, I got to stop. Like my first 5 scripts were made into movies and I go, well, I got to stop I got to stop rewriting. I got to write it and look at the results. My Way or the Highway, cut to me with oranges, bag of oranges. But yeah. You didn't see the 2 movies I directed? What? Hello? Come back. Phil, don't turn us off. I'll do that black and white Catwoman for you.
I mean, it is interesting because I remember I was reading online about how there are some people that are like, would Tim Burton ever go back to doing another Batman movie? Right? Is there a world where he would try to do a Michael Keaton version of this or whatever? And since DC is kind of pretty agnostic about any sort of connections between any of these things, they could kind of do whatever they want. Is that something you would be interested in doing?
Sure. I'm liking this old. I mean, my brother, the director who directed Mean Girls, he says yes to everything. I say no to everything, but that I'll say yes to that.
Okay. So to wrap this up, I wanted to ask you, since we talked a little bit when we were emailing, you brought up other films that you wanted to talk about as opposed to this one. What are some of your favorite films from 1992? Do you sort of off the dome?
Oh yeah. Yeah. No, I think I gave you my top 10 list from 1999. I don't have it recorded, but I think off the top of my head, it was, I mean, just, it was Unforgiven, Reservoir Dogs, which is, sure. But Deep Cover was my top 10. Raise the Red Lantern was number 3. Mm-hmm. And of course, I'm looking forward to your episode on Billy August, The Best Intentions. That's definitely going to be a real ratings coup. Hal Hartley's Simple Men. I know, another big vote getter.
Sure.
One False Move.
Yep, we did that one. Yeah.
And
great movie.
Oh, and I wouldn't have put this in my top 10 at the time. Mm. I rewatched it. I think it's a masterpiece. Mm. We kind of all as a nation glossed over it, even though we all paid to see it. But Basic Instinct is an incredible movie.
Yeah, we did. We had Karina Longworth on to talk about Basic Instinct.
Oh yes, of course you did.
And it was, you know, that movie is. Legit, I mean, obviously it's crazy, it's Verhoeven, but it's great.
I mean, I was just watching it agog, like, yeah. God, every line is a fucking home run.
Yeah. And it looks amazing. Like it's it's
a big fucking movie. It's a big glossy. I mean, you know,
it's great.
And it's not a superhero movie. It's like it looks like $1 billion, yet it's just people and it's fantastic. Yeah. So
I made $400 million in 1982. So
yeah, Jesus. It paid for itself. Yeah, no.
God. Many times over.
Yeah, no, yeah. I'm down now. I'm going back to my heroin addict. That analogy is like when it comes to movies about sexuality, now I'm just like snorting Karina Longworth podcast instead of like getting a real syringe full of good shit. Not that her shit isn't great, but you know,
it's pretty great.
It's still a podcast as opposed to a movie. I'm sure she would trade it in for 10 great erotic thrillers made today.
She absolutely would, as would her husband, I imagine. But I do think that it's been really interesting looking at 92, because I think it is a fulcrum point in a lot of ways. I think
such a great year.
And it turns pretty quickly after this, right? I mean, you got your Jurassic Park is 93, and it kind of feels like special effects become, you know, the modus operandi, and we're still feeling that today. It's so interesting that Batman Returns comes out in this year, you know what I mean? A year that still has movies made for adults, right? Like this movie, it's not, you know, for quadrantine necessarily, but it is sort of a movie that's going to hit the older people. And it's kind of, it's just a different time of making studio movies. And that's why we were lucky enough to get this movie to come out.
Yeah, no, you pick two great years, 1999 and 1992.
Yeah. Well, Daniel, I can't thank you enough for doing this. It's been, I mean, a true, my 12-year-old self is jumping up and down inside.
Your 12-year-old self is like, what the fuck? You're doing Batman Returns? We hated that movie.
Well, okay, my 13-year-old self. My teenage self is incredibly thrilled to be able to talk to you, to pick your brain a little bit, and to get somewhat of a sense of what it was like to make this phenomenal movie that still stands the test of time, that people still talk about today. You know, I'm so thankful. So I really appreciate
it. Well, you're very welcome. And then meet as many fans as I can get.
And I hope that you'll come on and talk about another movie that you didn't actually write.
Yes. Well, yeah, as a friend of mine, Josh Olson, who wrote History of Violence, who did he picked 1992 for his own podcast. Mm-hmm. But Batman Returns, superhero movie for people who hate superhero movies.
Absolutely. The best kind of people. That brings the best people together.
Not that I hate superhero movies.
Well, Daniel, thank you again, and I'll reach out and we'll talk movies again soon.
Okay, man. Great to see you.
See ya. Bye.